for gas. If you were producing prior to March 31, 2006, your tax would be calculated on the previous 12-month average. If you come into production after that, the 17.7 cents was the average of all the fields in the Cook Inlet at that time. So that's what the 17.7 cents is based on. The next page, page 3, this is a sample tax calculation on Cook Inlet gas. Most of you recognize probably both calculations. The calculation on the left is the way April tax is calculated. The one on the right is the ELF tax calculation. So I'll walk down through the numbers here quickly just to explain to the audience how it's calculated. The taxable MCF per day, for instance, 20,000, 30 days in a month, your total taxable MCF for the month is 600,000. We use the wellhead value of $5 per MCF. Therefore, your wellhead value would be $3 million. You are allowed to deduct OPEX and CAPEX. In this example, a total of $145,000 to get to your PTB. That's the magic number that is discussed quite a bit. So that's your $2.9 million. The taxable gas and BTU equivalent barrels, this is your barrel of oil equivalent, and in statute that's currently set at 6 to 1. So that's your 600,000 divided by 6, you get your 100,000 BTU equivalent barrels. So the PTV per BTU is 100,000 divided into the 2.9 million gives you $28.6. And this is the number that you set your base rate and progressivity if there's progressivity. So if it's over $30, that's when the progressivity would kick in. So for this example, there is no progressive tax rate. It's just a 25% base rate. Therefore, the eighth calculation would be $713,000. On the other side, ELF is obviously a lot easier to calculate. You have your 20,000 taxable MCF a day, 30 days, your 600,000 taxable. You simply multiply that by your 17.7 cents, and your tax ceiling would be 106,000. So that would be the lower of the two, and that's what would apply. The next page.
Excuse me a minute. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just before we go on, and I know this is an elementary slide. We've struggled with this issue in Cook Inlet for several years, the resources table and then the finance table. But I'm not so sure, Mr. Tangeman, that this is so elementary, it's got little to no value. Clearly, to me, these are not the values that whatever be involved in the, as far as working towards the treasury, because there's, substantially other issues involved here. There's credit issues. There's dilution issues within the oil that's produced. It's an elementary, overview of the tax calculations, but I think there'd be any value to this committee, or in particular to the finance committee coming this winter, we're going to have to add substantially more detail to it. So we can take a look at and see, how it is the tax structure in Cook Inlet affecting Cook Inlet, because intentionally we ring fence Cook Inlet, as you mentioned earlier, to stimulate the development of Cook Inlet, and then added credits, and then a year ago, Mr. Chairman, we had the Wagner Hail Mary with additional credits. So we can see the activity that's taking place. So we know we're going in the right direction for getting some production for Cook Inlet. But my concern is, as we go down that road, that we also have an accurate reflection of what's going on to the Treasury. And my concern is this, we're not going to see $106,000 in the Treasury.
Through the Chair, Senator Stedman, I agree. This is this is an elementary look at the way the tax is calculated, and it's meant to be. I've been given a half hour to discuss this. We have a lot of folks behind me that are going to get, and when we do get into the resources meetings and the Senate finance meetings, we are going to have to get into this a lot more in depth, because, you know, this is an example where you have to calculate this on every platform throughout. Their tax credits are going to be different for different corporations. Once you start throwing a lot more variables into the equation, so 6-to-1, how realistic is that today? There's clearly a lot of more detail that would go into the actual calculation for a corporation. So this was meant to be a elementary to give everyone a flavor of how it's calculated under ACES versus how it's calculated under L. And simply that for today. So, but I do agree that we'll have to dig into this a lot more.
Senator
Stebbins, this is a heads up. It's coming, but we're going to most likely spend the vast majority of time this winter, I think, in the legislature doing the subject. I don't want to cook him, but north of here, it would be nice to, when you assemble the slides and information, that you not only integrate the oil and gas within Cook Inlet, and as Cook Inlet will actually push us beyond Cook Inlet. I mean, this relationship goes substantially market area. But we integrate Cook Inlet together, and then we have our Arctic tax structure, and then we can see how the blend comes together. Because at some point, we're going to be coming back and looking at Cook Inlet to not only see the success or failures we have under the current tax structure and credits, but also any potential modifications or corrections or additional stimulus that may or may not be needed. So just to make it, just to give you a heads up on the attraction, I'm going to kind of start to talk to you. Yeah.
Thank you, sir. Sure. Looking forward to it.
Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have some of the same concerns that Senator Stedman had also, but I think this is a real easy look, and while it doesn't delve all the way down into the tax credit issues and things like that, I think that you can see, and the public should be able to see, is that before ACES, this was a tax. After ACES, this is the new tax. And Alaskans need to realize that when we get into this tax debate, that when we raised the tax to the oil industry during the ACES program, that is a, 700% increase in tax to one industry at one time. And I think that we need to take that into consideration in the long-term effects on what effects that actually has with oil exploration and oil development, and also investment in the state of Alaska. So, just a comment, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Stedman?
I just can't help but take the bait on that one. These are not real numbers. This is a simplistic view of our tax calculation system. These numbers do not exist anywhere close to the Treasury. So, they're just, I guess, an extremely high-level view that has virtually no economic value that I can see. Because if we calculated this depending on the corporations who we're dealing with and what kind of oil they may or may not have, these whole numbers could turn negative. So I think we've got a lot of steps to put in here to take a look to actually see what we actually have in front of us. But clearly, it's in the policy of the direction of the state to incentivize Cook Inlet. I agree with Chenault on that. I mean, this is a,
yeah. Let me say one thing. This is, I agree with some of what's been said, but this is not a hearing to talk about what we're going to do in Juneau. This is a hearing to just get a capsulation of Cook Inlet and what's going on and happening in the gas business of Cook Inlet now. the reason we asked Bruce to kick it off is just to show the disparity between the tax structure on the North Slope, north of the Brooks Range, and Woods and Cook Inlet. And there is a subsidization going on, rightfully so. I mean, the bulk of the people in the state of Alaska are the end users of the gas products. So it kind of demonstrates that. But the one thing I wanted to ask before going further, we did use a 6-to-1 ratio. What would you say would be a more realistic ratio to use, say, the North Slope oil yesterday was $110 a barrel, gas was $378 or something. What would that turn this ratio into if we were to recalculate the difference in the taxes that you showed here?
Senator Wagner, it's clearly greatly different. I look at it from what's in the statute currently, and it is 6-to-1, so that's what
right.
you have to use. But it's obvious that there is a significant difference. The price of oil has gone up, and the price of gas went down. So I don't know the exact calculation off the top of my head, but it's not close to 6-to-1 currently.
Would you say it's significantly past 20-to-1?
Perhaps.
About 25-to-1, maybe?
Sounds like you've got
that's enough said on that, but that's just the way the picture looks to me.
Correct.
Go ahead and continue with your presentation. Thank you.
So the next several slides, starting with slide 4, I'll walk through the production tax credits that are available to explorers and producers. The qualified capital expenditure credit, the OC3A, the carry forward loss credit. This is a summary sheet. I'll walk through the each one a little bit more as we go through the slides. But the carry forward loss credit or the net operating loss credit is the 023B credit. Well lease expenditure credit, 023L. The small producer credit, which is based on amount of production, that's the 024C. The alternative credit for exploration is 025. The jack-up rig credit, which is obviously an issue of this discussion, is the 025L. And then gas storage facility credit is 4320.046, which is actually taken against your corporate income tax, not the production tax. So we included that in this discussion because it is relevant to the equipment level. Slide 5 is a little more detail on the 023 credits. They're credits for qualified capital expenditures, so that's up to 40%. And the Section B is the 25% carry forward annual loss credit. If you want to get into any more detail, I know we've presented to several of the committees during the session, but we do have some folks online that could answer questions if you so choose. But page 6 is the continuation of the 23 credits, which is the 23L. This is the 40% credit for well lease expenditures, which was introduced for the Cook Inlet only. It's still 20% north of 68 degrees latitude. And this was done 2 sessions ago, I believe, where it was increased to 40% of the cooking. Slide 7 is the small producer credit, OC4. So up to $12 million based on average daily production. It's production under 50,000 barrels a day is eligible. And between 50 and 100,000 barrels a day, it's then prorated down to zero. So once you hit 100,000, this tax credit goes away. Credit can only be applied against tax liability. They cannot be cashed in. And they cannot be carried forward. So it's an annual. Slide 8, the 025 credit. Alternative tax credit for oil and gas. This is the exploration tax credit. It's either 30 or 40% eligible. depending on where the drilling and exploration is taking place, is based on well location and proximity to existing wells and boundaries. I believe it's outside of 10 miles of an existing, if you're eligible for the 40, inside you're eligible for the 10, or 30. And this requires, in order to be eligible for this tax credit, certain information is required to be turned over to DNR, and then the tax credit is available. Slide 9 is the 025L credit, the Cook Inlet Jackup Rig credit that was just brought into existence a few years back. Eligible for the first three unaffiliated persons using the same jackup rig that drill an offshore exploration. The credit is 100%, 90%, 80% for the three geographic wells. Total available is $67.5 million between the three. And there is a repayment requirement if exploration activity turns into production.
Senator Stebbins.
Mr. Chairman, folks, I'm getting a capacity from the folks going on with it. Just as a quick note, we have put that $67.5 million in this year's budget. So just, you know, as we walk through this stuff, I'm sure there's people from at home or around the state watching. But those funds are sitting there available to be dispersed to the industry when all the proper paperwork is filed and completed and stamped.
And if they aren't used this year, does that mean that Representative Chenault and Olson and I get to reappropriate?
No, but we'll hopefully roll it forward in the next year. Otherwise,
I just couldn't pass it.
It'll still be available for credit.
Probably some type of a line in there we missed that says they know the hydro project.
Okay, go ahead, Bruce.
And obviously, there is a rig out there currently now. It hasn't progressed to the point where we've received tax credit applications. This also requires information to be turned over to DNR, and then the tax credit will come into play. So we're in the process. Well, we're not in the process. Companies are in the process that will eventually lead to this tax credit being addressed. Slide 10 is the Cook Inlet Gas Storage Credit. Like I said, it's applicable against the state corporate income tax for the company. It's equal to $1.50 per MCF of working gas storage capacity, up to the lesser of $15 million or 25% of start. Storage facility must have working gas storage capacity of at least 500 MCF and withdrawal capacity of 10 million MCF per day. And that was the extent of my presentation.
And just an aside to that, while we're on that subject, we're going to have a field trip at 4 o'clock this afternoon to go tour that gas storage facility. It's just right now you were almost to it, Senator Stedman, when you got it on the wrong way on the bridge. But it's only about half a mile down the road, so we've arranged a tour for the staff that are here, for the senators, representatives. Okay. Question, Senator Stedman.
Just a quick note and a question. I just got to remember I'm from an island that's 7 miles of road north and south. We're not just all these entertainers. But anyway, Mr. Tanner, could you give us a brief rundown on the royalty structure? Because that, you know, for the folks listening at home, I wouldn't want them to get the impression that there is zero revenue potential coming from the basin here to the treasury. But we do have royalties, which haven't been mentioned today, and we have, I think your department has possibly adjusted some of that stuff in reflection to the tax structure standpoint. give myself a little closer point.
Through the chair, Senator Steadman, the royalty is actually handled by the Department of Natural Resources. I'm vaguely up to speed on it. It's set at 12.5%. I believe they do have the flexibility authority to adjust those rates if the need is there. But that's a rather deferred Department of Natural Resources to get any detail.
And I think those run out. I can't remember. I think there was a date on which those. Is it this year? Yeah. So they'll have to be revisited probably. Okay. Representative Seat.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bruce, could you just explain for everyone a little bit on the gas storage, the corporate income tax? Who gets that? In other words, is this going to producers that are using the gas storage, or is it the gas storage corporate gas storage entity itself?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, it would be for the owner operator of the storage facility itself, and it would go against their corporate.
Any further questions of Mr. Tangeman? Online, Senator McGuire? Can you hear me, Liesl? She might not be there anymore. Okay, if there are no other questions, thank you very much, Mr. Tangeman. Our next presenter will be Joe Griffith. With Artec, excuse me just a minute. A brief at ease, please.
This JR pointed out Senator Steadman's question on revenue for Artec now, property taxes.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Corporate taxes, property taxes, right. All of them. Right. And royalty. So all three of those are in check.
Did you want to?
Yes, sir. I think it was just
up for royalty
commissioners.
Yeah, because some of the production got hurt.
I can put my lip kicking in it.
That pressure was on producers. That's why the original guy didn't care if they had capital.
Well, it all has to be applied for. You're talking about the royalty relief?
No, the
corporate income tax.
The corporate income tax for the gas storage.
Right.
That didn't go through the organization. No. That has a storage that goes on to produce.
That goes to producers again.
And so,
the production incentive.
That's why I was questioning.
The question to royalty can be answered in part when JR comes up tomorrow. Because he's got the Oscar, which is the trip that you're going to take on Friday.
Yeah. And then what is you guys want to do is just roll them all in and have a snapshot of what's
that.
Yeah. You can't spend $100 million on it there.
Yeah, the department. Thank you. Yeah, we'll have to get the department to get the resources back. Okay, we'll come back to order. Next presenter, as I said, is Joe Griffith, the president of Artec. It's confusing because there's a company here, been in business for about 40 years, named Artec.
Well, but, hopefully we can do a business that
way. Go ahead, Joe. Appreciate you coming today.
Glad to be here. As the chairman said, my name is Joe Griffith. I'm the current president of Artec, an organization that was created about a year ago on the ashes of the Gretzky bill that didn't go anywhere. Five of the six utilities in the rail belt got together and created a rail belt generation and transmission cooperative. And we called it Artec. We thought it was a cute name. I don't think we realized that somebody else was using the name at the time, but so far there hasn't been major confusion. And ARCTEC stands for the Alaska Rail Belt Cooperative Transmission and Electric Company. That's a mouthful, and we thought ARCTEC made it a lot simpler. We are very pleased to have received a grant from you folks in the amount of $56 million, and I will explain where that is in a moment and progress being made on that. But anyway, the entire rail belt thanks you for that largesse and thinking of the rail belt energy situation. There is a plan of sorts that I think we could easily call the Rail Belt Energy Plan. ARCTEC is trying to pick that up and make it a real-world plan. It's a derivative of the Rail Belt Integrated Resource Plan that AEA started 3 or 4 years ago. There's been about 5 years' worth of effort went into earlier versions of that in addition to the RIRP, and we're continuing another segment of that as we speak, and I'll explain that more to you in a moment about that. The South Central Power Project is the Chugach Electric ML&T partnership on the new power plant in Anchorage being built at the Chugach headquarters site. The Eklutna Generation Station project is Matanuska Electric, 170 megawatts of plant to be built at the Eklutna site, which is the old powerhouse site for the original Eklutna hydroelectric project. Battle Creek is, and you can see these, Battle Creek is on near Bradley Lake. And the intent of Battle Creek is to divert about 30,000 megawatt hours worth of additional water into Bradley Lake. That hasn't received the full go-ahead as yet, but there's money placed on it, and people are working today. The good news is that no one has found any fish in the area that affects the diversion, so we think it's going to be rather painless to do it. Probably a $30 million project, and there's in the neighborhood of $3 to $5 million that's going into it as we speak. There are several transmission projects, and I won't give you the great detail on them because they are very confusing. The whole transmission system is probably as confusing as our tax system, but let me quickly sum it up here. There's two transmission lines run from Fairbanks down to Healy. One of them was funded, one of the last efforts that was funded when AEA was as it was originally. The second one has been there an eternity. That was built by to provide a path to get the 25 megawatts of the Healy coal site up to Fairbanks. The Alaska Intertie runs from Healy down to Thielen. A portion of that from Thielen to Willow belongs to NEA. It's under lease to Alaska Energy Authority. And this was the 1984 project that AEA, one of their two large successes, two big ones. One of them was at Intertie. The other one is Bradley Lake right down here. Some of the other things that are underway in the rail belt, the geothermal project is proceeding, and they drilled one additional well this year. Fire Island just went before the Regulatory Commission. That's 17 megawatts of wind power on Fire Island. Chugach has agreed to take that. Matanuska Electric agreed to take 15% of the output as well. That is not finalized on the prices of that, but it looks like it's in the $90 to $95 a megawatt hour range. The Eklutna Generation site is Matanuska's project, about 6 miles down the road from the existing Eklutna Hydro. South Anchorage is the Chugach ML&T joint effort. There is an intertie several intertides here that come from Beluga around the inlet, one that crosses the inlet to Elmendorf Air Force Base, and then an intertide that comes from Bradley Lake up across the Homer, up to Nikiski, over to Quartz Creek, and all the way back into Anchorage. And those are the highways that the power gets to our people. It's a weak system. They're single contingency type systems, but so important to our lifestyle because they are the means by which we deliver the power to them. I won't bore you with the numbers of the projects, but that $56 million that you folks appropriated last year is a major factor in upgrading the system. And we're going to upgrade from Nikiski over to Quartz Creek, from Quartz Start on the Quartz Creek up the University segment, and some other projects in here. A big one is the that was in that $56 million was SAFE, that's the Cook Inlet Gas Gathering System, and we changed the valving on that that connection between Nikiski and Tionic so we can move gas in either direction. That's an extremely important undertaking. I understand it's going to require some compression, and the compressors are not in yet, so I don't think it's fully usable, but at least we can get gas going in both directions. Today, the gas system strength is on the Kenai. It used to be on this side. Unfortunately, the major delivery to Anchorage comes from a 20-inch line from Beluga up to Palmer and around the corner and back down to MLMP Plant 2. And that's the bulk of the population of the state is on that 20-inch line. That's one we protect, and we hope we never run into any difficulties with that. There's another wind power project that Golden Valley is doing at Eva Creek, and that's proceeding on as we speak.
How many megawatts is that, Joe?
Eva Creek, 25, I believe, is what they're looking at. We're looking at LNG importation, and Golden Valley in Fairbanks is looking at importation of North Slope LNG by truck down the Hall Road. That will be a difficult project, but it will deliver energy at less than what Golden Valley is paying today. And as I'm sure as Senator Passband knows, the price of energy in Fairbanks is a problem for the people up there. I don't think any of us know the answer to the LNG importation, but I think every one of us believes it's going to happen. Because we can't get our own resources online, barring some really good production out of Cook Inlet, there's just no way we can get North Slope gas to us in time to solve the utilities gas problem. Wautana Hydro is up on the Susitna River, north about 125 miles upriver from Talkeetna, and that's a facility that AEA is working on. Arctec is supporting it, but we do not have an active role other than going to the meetings and giving them our advice. Just yesterday, they finally got around, AEA did, to asking how much would we, the utilities, require out of Wautana when and if it is produced. And we will be answering that soon. Do we work together in the rail belt? Yes, we do. We've got Arctec that you're hearing me speak about now. There's another group that's defining our operation of the intertides, and we are naming it the Intertide Management Committee. We think that we will have that in place within 60 days. And that will replace the old Intertie Operating Committee that operated the Alaska Intertie from Douglas or Teelan, depending on where you want to start it from, up to Ely. We have done most of the work on it. It awaits approval by the AEA Data Board, and I don't see any difficulty with that this time. I think we'll get it within 60 days. We're working with the Alaska Energy Authority. I meet with their project people periodically. Sarah and I meet periodically and talk about what's underway and how we're going to improve our energy situation. We have a Bradley Lake Project Management Committee that's the managers of the utilities. It's been in place since Bradley Lake was born, and it's worked well. It's one of the raving successes that we do have in government projects.
Mr. Griffith. Speaker Chenault has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joe, AEA, I'm sitting here listening to what you said about the Enterprise. Who owns the Enterprise? And I don't know if you want to go back to it.
Sure.
Who owns the Enterprise?
The state of Alaska owns Healy to Douglas.
Right.
MEA owns Thielen to Douglas.
Right.
Chugach owns from University to Quartz Creek. That's under the Bradley Lake Agreement. Homer owns Quartz Creek all the way to Bradley Lake, except the portion of that was built with Bradley Lake money. And it's under an agreement, so as long as Bradley Lake is there, Homer has to move the power over. That's a real benefit for Homer, because no matter what they do, they get energized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The Alaska Enterti Agreement is the current agreement by which we, the utilities, operate the Enterti, and you say, well, that can't be that big a problem, but it really is. It's not so much a problem, but it's a coordination issue to ensure that, first, the most efficient energy is online at all times. Secondly, you have all the reserves that you need there, because a blip anywhere on this system can cause a breakdown of the whole system. Now, thankfully, we haven't had one of those since 1989, but the last big one we had in 89 took 5 days to put it all back together, so it's no small undertaking to coordinate that. We work together on legislative efforts. We will be bringing to you, through AEA, our legislative request for next year, and you will see, again, an awful lot of Enterti requests in there, because that's one of the weakest portions of our system today. We're working with a number of independent gas explorers. Everyone in Cook Inlet that we have talked to. NSTAR is building the SIGs, and the chairman just mentioned your field trip to that. SINGSA, Cook Inlet Natural Gas Storage, Alaska. We're working also on LNG importation, and we work jointly on crisis plans and exercises. Every one of us believes that this will be the most difficult year we face. Things that isn't online, the gas supply with the LNG plant shut down will be less robust. And we're going to have, and we get a good cold snap, it's going to take some tank management to get us through that. Our alternatives in fuel is Cook Inlet exploration, and you all are certainly up to speed on that. The Aegea spur line is a factor. If Aegea goes forward, I think it's pretty much a given that there will be a spur line come off either Delta Junction or Glen Allen. The bullet line is being pushed by the ASAP folks. LNG importation is being looked at. Propane, believe it or not, is being looked at. In fact, I've asked the producers of the engines that I will put in the effluent site to run some tests on burning of propane. First, because it's a wonderful backup, and secondly, because I can buy it cheaper than I can buy diesel fuel. And last resort is burn diesel. The plant, any of the plants that have a supply and the fuel nozzles fixed can burn diesel. There are dual fuel ones. MLMP Plant 2 has a dual fuel capacity. The Eklutna gas generation site will have dual fuel capability as well. Gas is exceptionally important to our members. My comment on that always is that heat and light is not optional in Alaska. The electrics have to protect the gas system, because we're the ones who can shut people off and reduce the demand on the gas system. The gas deliverers have little capability to do that, and the worst thing that can happen to you is to let the gas system decline to the point that it fills up with air, the pilot lights go out, and you have to go back in. It takes months to prepare. So we would plan to do rolling blackouts if we had got into a serious gas shortfall. And those plans are worked out. In fact, we discussed them earlier this week on how we would do it and how we allocate the shares of the blackout. And remember, electricity runs everything. My comment is it's the grease for our economy. It heats our homes and businesses. It powers your communication network. It even opens the doors to your business. You say, well, we'll get generators, but electricity isn't on. You can't pump the gas out of the tanks and to sell it to people. And people don't think about that thing. Traffic control, what a mess when the lights don't work. Communication system. One of the big outages we had a year ago, the MTA system went down because they ran out of gas at their generators at the various sites. And people became really incensed that they couldn't communicate with anybody. It's amazing to see the understanding people have of the ability to communicate. And I said, well, you cannot, what do you mean we can't talk? And everything else. So we know how important electricity is, and it's important to our gas system. But first priority has to be our gas system. And we always like more supply in that if we can get it. The electrics have a challenge different a little bit than NSTAR for that I just explained to you. Unfortunately, the ASAP line will not come in time to solve the immediate problem that we face. So we've got to do something soon. And NSTAR has taken a step with the SINGSA facility. That will help a lot for all of us. If we could get a reliable cook inlet supply, that would be wonderful. We need to drill. We need incentives for these folks to be able to drill. We need quick permitting, and it very clearly is the least expensive option for the entire energy situation. And unfortunately, I don't see any way to get out of importing LNG. I think we're going to have to do that to get us to the next phase of the fuel situation. There are some of the prices. I won't bore you with those, but you've seen those kind of numbers. If we could get the bullet line up to 500, then you're down about $9 an MCF. And you can look at the various comparisons there, and it gives you a classic example of what's happening in Fairbanks. Their fuel costs $20-some a million BTUs, and you can get white birch for half that. So what are you going to do? You're going to burn wood. And then what happens to your air quality and all of that? And that's a real problem up there. And I think in time, if we don't do something to resolve that, we will end up causing problems for the federal installations that are up there that are a big piece of our economy. That's a quick overview of what's happening with energy in the rail belt. I didn't touch on any of the bigger issues that face people in the southeast. Of course, they have some good energized and good hydro facilities. Other folks in the bush in various parts of the state have their own problems and challenges.
Excuse me a minute, Joe.
Yes, sir.
Senator Passman.
Sure. In the slide on the price comparison where you have LNG import from the North Slope, is that intended to be a tanker transport from the North Slope?
No, that was trucking. And that takes a lot of trucks to run a power plant. I think Golden Valley is looking at something like 40 trucks.
20 each way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Per day.
Are there questions of Mr. Griffin? I got to apologize for calling you Griffin because the guy just came in sitting behind you. His name is Griffin, and you're Griffin. So.
Well, I think we're all related.
If there are no questions at this time, we're due for a break in 5 minutes, but I'd like to go forward a little more. I've been six or eight people come in after we had introductions, so If those of you that walked in late didn't get a chance to introduce yourself, please stand up and do so.
With XTO Energy. Harold Hines, Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority.
Brad Norsky, Homer Electric.
Bill Gallagher, Homer Electric.
Dan Sutter, Exxon Mobil.
David Hall, Talent Energy.
Is that it?
Jeff.
Oh.
Jeff Logan.
Jeff Logan. Lobbyist. With that, we'll take a break until 10:30. At that time, we come back. Wade Hutchings with Marathon will be presenter. Back to order. I want to make a couple of announcements. On your in front of you is a handout by Harold Hines. Two-page information only. We won't have a presentation, but he wanted to get this distributed. And Mary, are there copies back on the desk, or are there copies there?
They're right here.
Okay, so there's copies available for the public. Secondly, we have a dinner tonight, and it's an open dinner. Everybody's welcome. The Alliance is giving a dinner, and it's over at Pizza Paradisus. So it starts at... let's see, 6 o'clock it starts, I think, drinks and dinner at 7 or 6:30 or 7. But it opens up at 6. Is that right, Jane? Dinner's at 6?
Right after the finish of
lunch. So, it's going to take us 2 hours.
And no host bar.
And be a no host bar there, so when you show up. Darn. So... with that, I'll turn the meeting over to Wade Hutchings, who's the new business unit manager for Marathon. Been here about 2.5 months, Wade.
Yes, sir.
So with that, go ahead and proceed with your presentation, please.
Well, good morning. As was stated, my name is Wade Hutchings. I'm the asset manager for Marathon Oil Company's Alaska business. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today before the committee on the topic of Cook Inlet exploration and development. As you know, Marathon Oil has a rich history as a company and a rich history exploring for and producing gas in Alaska. The company recently completed a major corporate transformation where we spun off our entire refining, marketing, and transportation business into a standalone company now known as Marathon Petroleum Corporation. The remaining entity, Marathon Oil Corporation, is now an independent oil and gas exploration production company, still headquartered in Houston, Texas, with worldwide operations. Although, as you can see here, we have a new logo, we have new competitors in our independent exploration and production space, we have the same enduring commitment to safe, clean, and responsible operations. There have been several very positive changes in the oil and gas investment environment of the Cook Inlet as of late. And I just want to note a few today for you. The first two I wanted to note are Cook Inlet tax reform and several process improvements at the RCA. The tax reforms have allowed us to make our projects more competitive on a global scale and to continue to access investment dollars from corporations. I think, as you're aware, we compete for capital within our own company with projects all across the world. The process improvements within the RCA have created a lot better stakeholder alignment and timeliness of decisions, which has been critical to help us plan our business better. Most of these changes have come from direct legislation or via legislative support, and as such, I would like to extend our thanks to you and your other colleagues in the House and Senate for all the work you've done to make those changes possible. I'll also note today that we are pleased to see recognition within the DNR of a need for continued streamlining of the regulatory process. We're supportive of their recent efforts because at the end of the day, a predictable, transparent regulatory and fiscal regime is critical to continue to attract investment dollars to the state and to the Cook Inlet. Now, Marathon has spoken at length about Cook Inlet supply-demand balance in the past, both publicly and before legislative bodies such as this one. We do continue to see a crossover point in the Cook Inlet where supply is below demand on an annual basis, sometimes in the next 2 to 3 years. Certainly, increased exploration, development, and storage capacity can potentially offset that imbalance for several years. However, we do think a focus on ensuring sufficient supplies of natural gas, both internal and external to the basin, is certainly the necessary and responsible approach. Our base business in the Cook Inlet remains strong, and we remain committed to investing in the Cook Inlet. In 2010, we averaged gas sales of 104 million cubic feet of gas per day, which represents roughly 34% of total Cook Inlet gas sales. The primary objective of our Alaska business is meeting the contractual gas sale commitments to our customers. Our other primary objectives are operating our assets in a safe, clean, and responsible manner, and ensuring that our assets produce competitive returns. Meeting our current and anticipated future contractual commitments requires investment on our part in maintenance and in new equipment to keep our wells and fields producing reliably, particularly during the winter months when we have peak demand. Given the supply-demand balance I noted earlier, we do recognize opportunities to develop additional resources and capture incremental gas sales. Our capital investment plans reflect a pace that is fairly in line with our recent investment history. These investments will be in many forms, in the form of drilling new wells to go after deeper or new targets, drilling additional development wells within our fields, and trying to add additional productive capacity within the well base that we currently have. The investment that we've made in gas storage in our Kenai gas field continues to be a critical component of our operating model. The DNR has listed this storage at a volume of 60 BCF with a deliverability of 60 million cubic feet of gas per day. This storage capacity has been an important part of our operational ability to both contract and meet winter peak gas sales. Provided regulatory clarity is maintained, we plan to continue to invest in and utilize this gas storage. We also plan to continue to invest in our people and our local communities. Over 90% of our Alaska-based employees are Alaskans. We are seeing some of our technical staff relocated to areas of high industry activity in North Dakota and Texas and other places. This is, however, driving us to replace those individuals, most of them locally, to fill the open positions with our own assets. We are very pleased with the strides our team has made lately to operate safely and cleanly. We recently went 18 months without a recordable injury by both our staff and our contractors, who must take the same approach to safety as our employees. We also continue to see important improvements in our ability to limit and even eliminate minor spills to the environment. You will continue to see Marathon be an active and engaged member in the communities that we live in. Lastly, I'd like to make a few comments regarding the ASAP project, and in many ways you can expand this to include any other proposed solution to meet the energy demand of the Cook Inlet area. We certainly recognize and appreciate that state government needs to strike the right balance between two very important objectives, namely meeting South Central Alaska's energy demand and encouraging a vibrant Cook Inlet E&P environment. These two objectives are not mutually exclusive, but care will need to be taken to balance between and achieve both. In addition to potential for resources and regulatory and fiscal certainty, investment in exploration and development requires a high degree of market certainty. Simply put, we often ask the question, will there be a market for new gas production within the inlet? Historically in the inlet, the ebb, flow, and upward limit of market availability has inhibited robust natural gas exploration and development. The reality is that projects like ASAP introduce new uncertainties for producers in the inlet regarding the future of the gas market within the inlet. Certainly the implications for the local consumption market, which today is estimated to be around 90 BCF a year, are important to this discussion. It's probably stating the obvious that a pipeline like ASAP will require significant long-term contracts to be viable. Hence, it's not a stretch that such contracts could likely tie up all the uncontracted future local market in the unit. The throughput capacity of ASAP, as currently described, is roughly 180 BCF a year. That's essentially 500 million cubic feet a day. We certainly ask questions as to will this volume be sufficient, particularly on a monthly seasonally adjusted basis, to sustain or create industrial consumption centers similar to past cooking with gas markets. We also ask questions around what impact a project like this would have on market price for gas within the inlet, which at the end of the day really is the underpinning of resource development within the inlet. These are no doubt complex issues, but a lack of certainty in these areas creates uncertainty for long-term gas exploration and production projects. So what is clear is if these kinds of projects or these kinds of solutions create an environment where we end up with a very small industrial gas consumption market and a situation where nearly all of the local market is tied up in long-term contracts, then there is low incentive for future inlet gas exploration and development. We do think that there is a solution that can meet both of those key objectives, and so we encourage all parties to continue to work towards a balance of ensuring local demand is met, particularly during the peak in the winter months, and also ensuring that a robust Cook Inlet exploration and production environment still exists. Once again, I express my appreciation for your service and your interest in ensuring a robust Cook Inlet gas marketplace. Be assured that Marathon will continue to invest in the Cook Inlet to deliver on our commitment to our customers, and that we will continue to operate our assets in a way that protects the people who work for us and the environment, the community we live in. I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
Okay. Thank you, Wade. Are there any questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your discussion, as ASAP has gone forward, has the situation you're talking about the interaction between a bullet line concept as been proposed and development of Cook Inlet, has that been integral to that conversation, or are you bringing this forward more or less to us at this point in time?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I would say, generally speaking, it hasn't been a significant part of our current day-to-day operational discussion. But when we look at future wells and future development projects, that's what we look at is when those projects would come online in a year or 2 years, will there be the availability to contractually sell that gas in the industry? And so today we would continue to see that availability. And as I noted with the supply-demand outlook, there would potentially be even additional opportunities to sell that gas. So this is more of a longer-term uncertainty for us for bigger-picture investment projects in the industry.
Senator Pascal?
Somewhat following up on that theme, is your long-term plans influenced by export potential?
Through the chair, Senator Pascal, that's a good question. Generally speaking, with the pace of investment that we have had over the last couple of years and the pace of investment we continue to plan on having, those kinds of considerations haven't significantly impacted our plans.
Further questions? Seeing none. Thank you, Wade. Appreciate your time. Appreciate your testimony. At this time, I'd like to make one announcement. Just so everybody knows, we give credit where credit's due. The jump drive that the staff is using currently is furnished by XTO. We appreciate that. I believe those were Christmas presentations, or they're a presentation anyway, and they really work good. Mary loves hers. So with that, we'll take a brief Reef at Eve.
Can you can jump
back? We're a little ahead, but I think we're going to go on to the next presentation here when we get set up. Meeting back order. At this time, the next presenter will be Paul Abacare from Apache Corporation. He's the senior commercial advisor. Came to Apache, I believe, from a company named Marathon Oil. So, turn it over to you, Paul. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for allowing us as an Apache Corporation to do a quick presentation today. As a newcomer to the Cook Inlet, our presentation will be mostly focused on introduction to Apache Corporation and give you a little bit of update of where we are in the process right now. And so with that, I will go through these slides quite a bit, but I just want to give you an idea of who Apache Corporation is. Right now we have about 3 billion barrels of oil equivalent reserves. We're about 732,000 barrels per day. And just some of the significant positions, we operate in about 6 areas in the world. We're the largest producers in Egypt. We're the joint venture with Encana. We're the largest producer in the Canada Horn River Basin. We're the fourth largest producer in the Gulf of Mexico. We're number one, of course, in shallow waters. We're the second largest producer in Texas. We're the seventh largest producer in Argentina. And we have some production in the UK North. The mission of Apache is, and defines Apache, is based upon what do we stand for. And our mission is to grow a profitable global exploration production company in a safe and environmentally responsible manner for the long-term benefit of our shareholders. This is focused on two parts, which is transparency of our operations and our commitment to the environment. And we take those very dear to our hearts and how we operate worldwide. Just to give you an idea of where we're at and how we've come around. If we brag about our growth company, let the chart speak for itself. You see what we've done in the last 10, 15 years. And we continue that growth, and we are planning for that growth for the upcoming years as well. I'd like to have to concentrate on the new ventures for the Cook Inlet. And the International New Ventures Group is the group that I represent here, we're part of the Patch Group, has the Cook Inlet project, and we're in charge of that. We became the largest acreage holder in Cook Inlet with more than 800,000 acres. We first acquired 300,000 acres through a private purchase, and then through the last bid round, we acquired more than 500,000 acres.
Would you define that a little clearer? Because I know Alaska has a restriction of 500,000 acres, but that's on state lands alone, is it not? So your other 300,000 acres is non-state holdings?
Correct. The 500,000 limitation applies to state-owned land only. The way we've acquired our leases at this time, we intend to acquire some more leases in the future, is that we will be taking parts in existing units that the exemption or restriction does not apply to, and to privately held through either Siri or the Tionic or other nations that are presented here. So the 500,000 does not apply to us at this time. And we're very wary of that.
Thank you.
Our main focus is oil. And catch a lot of people off guard, but we are here for oil. And we believe the Cook Inlet has a lot of potential that has not been tapped yet. And so our biggest focus is oil. We would encounter some gas, I'm sure, but our biggest focus and our drive right now and our interest in the Cook Inlet is based on oil production. And that's what we are focusing on. And you will see that with our operations and our everything we do from now on is based on that. As most of you are aware, there is very limited 3D seismic in the area that has been done of late. So our biggest progress right now, or our biggest concentration, is on conducting a full Cook Inlet 3D seismic operation in the next few years. And that's what we've been concentrating on. It covers both onshore and offshore acreage. And we're going to operate here for many, many years. We're on a 25 to 30 year plan for the Cook Inlet. To give you an idea about the map we're covering, we have applied for a permit to cover everything in the red area here. We're talking about how this is here. And we're going to update on a three-year plan, and our first year is going to cover this area right here. So we're looking at the feasibility of, we're talking about new nodal technology that we have actually acquired through Apache that we're going to use to hook into energy. It has very minimal environmental effect, and to put it bluntly what it is, this new nodal system is called what we call a wireless nodal system. There are no wires that connect the nodes together. So we don't have to more cut into the environment, cut into the forest or the tundra, or whatever you want to call, to lay out those lines. These are simply set out there by people or by machines, whichever is easier. A man with a backpack can carry 8 of those nodes on the back. These are the onshore nodes right here. They weigh about 5 pounds each. And a tracker with a bear guard, gentleman with him, hopefully, would actually walk out and all GPS-oriented, where they would actually lay the grid system out by just simply taking the nose, just putting it on the ground. And that's what he does. There's no effect and minimal effect. Now, there'll be some holes shot, you know, for the seismic activity for the source, but those are also at the minimum. We drill a hole about a 1-inch horizontal, about 35 feet. We put a charge there in there, and that's about a 12-inch charge of dynamite or whatever the explosive we're using at the time, and then we just cover it back up. And that's why if you walk right by it, you will never know it's there. And it's all being done by GPS, and so all our guys know it. So what happens is the communication between the central base and the person who are walking. And they walk out, and he says, I'm at this location. Stop. Put the note, either drill the hole or put the note. And it's going to be a cross-grid pattern that's a little bit confidential that we'll be using to get the best effective 3D seismic that we have for the area. And we will be shooting most of the area for the cooking. And we are currently in discussion with other operators and other landowners in the area where we'll actually be able to share that information with them on certain conditions, of course. We are. On the offshore basis, we are using another new technology nodal system. And these are about 65 pounds, looks like a half a barrel of oil. And they're just dropped off by boats there. The only connection between them is just called a small tether line. That's all it is. So they have minimal effect on any, transportation, any movement of vessels, anything like that. They actually go down, lay down on the ground, on the bottom of the sea, at certain depth. And they have a special system set up on the top here, the way the fish doesn't give it clearance. But because of the tide in the Cook Inlet, 8 to 10 miles, knots, actually, we use that to our benefit because the tide, the way they're set up on top, will actually drive those into the bottom, into the silt. And they would actually be more better positioned that way. And they're all GPS located. They're all GPS. They have no transmitters on. So all they are is listening devices, as well as the onshore front. They're all just listening devices. So what happens, you put them out there, you set up your explosive, the crew comes back, picks them back up, takes them to the central base, they download the information, they recharge it because they're all separated, their main power source is the battery. That's always the rechargeable battery. And then we download the information, then the crew takes them back out again and puts them out again. Hopefully, the process will run a lot smoother than that because we'll have teams going back and forth and doing it. Currently, we're about, the way we have it set up now for the Cook Inlet, we're going to have about 6,000 nodes for onshore and about 2,000 nodes for the offshore system. And that's what we're not saying. Okay. The onshore drilling operations,
technician to help him out a lot. That's not the XTO jump drive, is it? Thank you.
No, there's no conspiracy here from the onshore drilling will be delivered, be done by, as you can tell, by this equipment here. Their Arctic setup, we will be using as much of the snow as possible, the snow-covered areas we'll be using these. So the operation is set up to be conducted year-round. It's based on the weather. The biggest, of course, hurdle we have right now is the permitting. You know, trying to keep up the permitting with our operations. We are a bit aggressive in our timeline, and we intend to get this done within the next 3 years. And so that has been our biggest challenge right now is the permitting to keep up with our crew as they progress through the area. Also, for areas that we can actually access, because we will not be, you know, cutting roads, we will not be doing anything fast. We are actually using helicopter rigs where they were drilling. It's a two-part system where you have a drilling part and then you have a compressor that comes with it. And the helicopter will be able to just uplift those, put it on the spot by GPS guidance, and the operator, which is commander, will come up together, operate it, and drill the holes for the drilling unit. And so there will be a minimum effect on the environment, a minimum effect on everything around it. As I said before, we have been going through a permitting process. We've been in the equipment for about a year now, and we have already started our seismic operations about a month ago. And as I showed you from the earlier map, we have started with a year one system, and we've got most of our permits to date have been on schedule or close enough. We have been very lucky with cooperation from Jennifer and your group, and we've been very cooperation with the DNR. They've been very helpful in our system setup. But as you can tell, this is Cook Inlet to do a 3D seismic activity right now. These are the permits you have to go through, including federal stuff like that. Luckily, we have had some very good help, local representation by Lisa Parker, and she's been very instrumental in our help in getting us where we need to get. And so far, we are on schedule. And the way our plan is set up, our president has already announced that we will do some exploratory drilling in 2012. And so I can't tell you where, but we are anticipating that we will be doing some exploratory drilling in 2012. At this time, I just want to say thank you for the opportunity to talk to you, and I can address any questions you might have.
Thank you, Paul. Other questions at this time? Speaker Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul, on your subsea seismic nodes that you're going to put down, whenever you, are you going to shoot that? I know onshore you're going to drill.
Yes, sir.
And set charges to do that, but how do you do that offshore? Am I going to be able to do that from onshore?
Well, somewhat, depending on the shallow part, we'll be using the onshore detonation to actually get that seismic. For the deep water, as you're correct, on the offshore part, we'll actually be using air guns in the water. And those have been permitted by the state and permitted by the federal as well to be used for offshore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? This is going along pretty fast. Thank you, Paul. I appreciate you coming and doing your presentation. We look forward to having you here in the inlet and being very busy with your activities. With that, we're going to have lunch delivered here, I believe, at, you know, what time?
Noon.
So we got an hour, so if there's something you need to do, feel free to do it, and we'll have lunch delivered here at noon, courtesy of the City of Kenai. And at this time, I want to thank the City of Kenai for their participation, their room, and the lunch we're going to be receiving. And also, at this time, thank the Kenai Alliance for the arrangements for tonight. So with that, we'll stand at ease, have lunch, and we'll be back at 1:30 with presentation to continue. At this time, we'll hear a presentation from Escapeda, involving the kitchen's development unit, and the presenters will be Bruce Webb and Vladimir, is it Kitty?
Cutting?
And if you would maybe tell the committee a little bit about each, and I know I'm familiar pretty well with Bruce, I met Vladimir, so if you could just give them a little bit of your background and then go on.
Well, I can start. Thank you, Chairman. My name is Bruce Webb, and I'm one of the vice presidents of Escapeda Oil Company. I was born and raised in Alaska, and I spent 13 years at the Department of Natural Resources and Permitting and Compliance. When I retired from the state, I went into private consulting, then went to work for Aurora Gas in the Cook Inlet. I stayed there about 5 years, and once the jack-up rig got close to Alaska, I jumped ship and came to Pescatella.
All right. Vladimir?
Vladimir Kadek. I'm a petrochemical engineer, 40 years of experience in drilling and production worldwide. Everything from Middle East to West Africa, Central Asia, Siberia, California. My last stop is in Alaska, so wherever there's oil and gas, I kind of tend to grab it. So.
You sound a lot like a lot of those BP guys you talk to all over the world.
Our presentation is like a two-part. Bruce Hill will give you a little presentation on long and treacherous road for the rig to get up here. And then I will have a few slides on how we would develop gas and oil and sort of early accelerated development for gas.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Okay, well, the rig left Galveston, Texas on March 18th, and that was the beginning of its three-month voyage to Nanaimo, British Columbia. And Nanaimo is when I became more involved with the project. So the slides that I'm going to be showing are pictures of the rig, because a lot of people don't know what the rig looks like and what a heavy lift vessel is and really how big it is. So the voyage from Galveston to Nanaimo was on the King Ching Tao heavy lift vessel, and this is a picture of it. It's about the size of a football field, and it's too large to go through the Panama Canal. So it had to go around the tip of South America. The rig is actually welded to the boat, and when we were in the southern Gulf of Mexico, we hit some high seas and had to pull over in Uruguay to re-weld the rig to the boat again and brace the leg. And that resulted in having some rather extensive leg inspections done while in British Columbia. These are just slides of the rig. It's, right now it's anchored off of a little island in Nanaimo, British Columbia. And this photo is when the heavy lift vessel is submerged and the jack-up rig is actually floated off. The jack-up rig is a barge and it has, you know, all the Coast Guard certification and everything. So as it's floated off, it's hooked up to three tugs. Two tugs will pull it forward, and one tug is used in the back to steer it. And here's the tugs right now. We towed it across the Bay of Nanaimo over to a dock that was used for logging. And as a little scale here, this is a 200-passenger British Columbia ferry. So it's the rig is actually, if you set it in a residential cul-de-sac, it would cover every house around the cul-de-sac. That gives you a little idea of just how large it is. It's pretty large. This was the dock at Nanaimo where it was jacked up, and we had to redo a lot of the high-pressure welding on the piping system in order for it to be able to handle the 15,000 pounds in the lower Cook Inlet and Jurassic. And this is just another view. This is the first picture we took of it in Kashimak Bay. So it's finally arrived in Alaska. This was August 7th. So that's 5 months from when it left the Galveston and went around the tip of South America and up the Chilean coast, along, you know, California, and it was a long voyage. So it was quite a feat to get here. It was not an easy task. And this is a picture off of the OSK dock in Mississippi, and you can see some of the Granite Point and Trading Bay jack-up drilling rigs in the background. This one is one that's actually the rig in the background. I can't remember if it's Baker or Dillon, but it's being dismantled right now. And so here you have a picture of a 60-year-old platform that's being abandoned, kind of the past of the Cook Inlet. And right next to it is the future of the Cook Inlet and the new exploration. But I like this picture personally. It's my favorite. Now, this is a picture of it while it's on location, and we actually have the conductor set. You can see it extending below the derrick. So this is one of the SISPRI boats that we contracted with, called the Drilling Fluids up to the ridge. Is this just another picture? And I believe that's it. That was my presentation, just so you can see what the rig looks like. And Vladimir is up next. Your tech guys helped me with this quite a bit.
I just want to say that I congratulate the people that came up with the idea of the Center for Circular Exploration. If it wasn't for those incentives, this rig, for sure, would never be here. It's just too expensive. Big oil companies didn't bring the jack up. Potential prospects are too small. And for little guys, it's very expensive, so this incentive really helped to bring the jack-up in the first year. We're quite confident that we will find oil and gas, and we sort of developed a four scenario for the HMYG unit. Number one is outrigger is a caisson that can be installed with the jack-up rig and the well drilled. What we call outrigger caisson well, 14-foot diameter. And it's very similar to what would be one leg for Osprey platform. And inside you have 30-inch conductors. Coast Guard requires that you have small helipad, small deck for in emergency quarters if somebody gets stranded out there. The gas development would be Sterling, Beluga, and upper Tyonic pipeline will be installed simultaneously as we're drilling the development wells. And there are generally two directions we would go. If we make the deal with ConocoPhillips, since we're only about 10, 12 miles south of the North Cook Inlet platform, we would send the gas to them, sell it to them. And then they ship it to shore, or we come down to East Portland and actually down with rig and some land. This is what it looks like. The spreaders are the driver case piled in, so that's for stability, so it doesn't rotate over. As I said, 14-inch banner. This is what the will look inside looks. Six well 30-inch piles. The nice thing about this is it can be fabricated in Anchorage, and possibly some of it could be fabricated right here in Kenai. And it certainly would be good for employment and whatnot. So it's about 6 months of engineering fabrication. In 18 months, you could have production, gas production at this time. You tow it to a location, upend it. There's the jack-up.
Can we back up a slide? We're talking about fabrication. I'd like to see that anchorage crossed out and put Kenai in there for good. Kenai and Nikiski.
We
got some of the best welders in the world here, and if they aren't the best, we got a teacher out at the college who can teach them to be.
We like it to be Kenai, so
okay.
As long as you have facilities, you got to roll that 14-foot
right.
Down. That you may have to do in Anchorage, but you can ship in sections. Weld it and we put them on the barge and
The big cantilever over the caisson. Here's the package that was on top. Also, you don't need any large cranes to install this. I mean, that's a lot cheaper, faster. Not to mention, there is no heavy lift barge cranes in there. That was the advantage. No barriers, minimum cost, short time to production, what I call accelerated production. Disadvantages, I don't see too many because monopod platform is, it says it's never been done in Cook England. Actually, monopod is, this will be just a mini monopod. So it has been done. The monopod is, I think, like 30 foot diameter. We looked at the next concept, subsea completion. They work well if you don't have ice areas. It certainly would work well in the outside the floating ice. Disadvantage is that if your well goes down, you really can't intervene until springtime, until you actually can bring up the jacket. But there's equipment today that you can sort of have a redundancy in the well, and it could last for 5, 6 years, 7 years. So I won't spend much time on the subsea. That has never been done in the container. This one here is interesting. There are some areas of known oil around the existing platform that you can't reach from the platforms, and these would could be the satellite-type well that you can tie back to the main mother platform and recover additional oil. So the whole thing revolves around enhanced recovery, maximized recovery, and everybody benefits. This is a single subsea Christmas tree. You have about four different satellite clusters in the template. Six well template.
Lemmer, question on the subsea well completion from the mud line to the tree cap. How far, what's the distance on that? How many feet?
You can see it on that. It's only a couple of feet. You get close to the, some of the guides actually sit on the seabed. And then the wellhead equipment, so if you look at from mud line to the tree cap, it's probably about 6 feet. Can you go back another one? Was it compact? No? See, there it is. It's what is called a compact subsea Christmas tree. And about 6 feet.
Okay, now I guess my question is, does that whole unit then stay on the ocean bottom?
Yes, sir.
With the cage around it, et cetera?
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure you're aware there's a lot of material down there that rolls around sometimes on the floor of Cook Inlet.
Yeah, they're what we call protective cages. This would have more protection than any of your pipelines.
So you'd have an additional cage to go around that.
Would deflect any rocks.
Yeah, okay.
But it would be much more protected than pipelines currently that are on the
right. Region. Thank you.
Next contact, two-deck platform. Oxford is a good example. And this advantage of it is you can only install it in shallow water, 40 to 60 feet. In this particular case, you don't need heavy lift barge crane. Well, we got 28 well capacity. Now, the
living quarters that you see on the right side of the office is fabricated in Anchorage and shipped to the platform. All right, the pre-deck platform we would be looking at if we have a large oil and gas discovery in the kitchen light unit. And we would model the design after steelhead, which seems to be the most suitable for middle of the cooking inlet. That's the shell platform. That's actually this one. That's the installation. I got these slides from a Shell engineer that actually was involved in installation of platform A and C. Many moons ago. There's the heavy lift barges are required to install a three-level platform. The gas lines, you know, they're 8 to 10 inches, depends on the volume. The six-well caisson, we projected about 10 million cubic feet per day per well, six wells, so somewhere between 50 and 60 million cubic feet a day of production, which would be handled 8-inch line either to North Cook Inlet platform or to the shore. That's sort of gives you an idea. Bruce looks pretty smart, but you see that little red dot, it's got a big dollar sign.
Bag of money.
Bag of money.
The program didn't have a artwork for a drilling rig.
He improvised. Okay. Those are 08 numbers. Originally, they would need to be updated. But by far, the operator takes them is the cheapest way to do it. Timeline, looks like I said, 18 months from engineering, fabrication, installation, and rig. That should be actually 6 wells because we wouldn't be able to reuse the exploration as a way of sliding the caisson over to existing plant. And that's about it. I hope nobody fell asleep.
Are there questions? So, in your estimate, though, if you're successful in penetrating gas zones that are producible, is that from the time of getting your data back on the well tests and everything, is it 18 months from that time, like you sold January the first year? Is that this January of 2012?
We're successful drilling through the gas zone this year. We can commission the engineering and fabrication during the winter season and have everything ready for next year. We'll have to come back on Kitchen Light 1 and deepen the well to the, you know, to get into the Jurassic. But following that, we would already have all the analysis done. We know that what reserves are. We would then, of course, we have to check with all the agencies, but we would recommend we start developing the six well, do the development well late next year, like third quarter.
Late next year?
Yeah.
So?
This year, the season pretty much over. We do the engineering, commission fabrication. That's at least 6 months. Mm-hmm.
So you would look at production in 2013?
Yeah, late 2012 or and early
2013,
because we probably wouldn't be able to drill all six wells in 2012.
Okay. Representative
Chenault? Hey, Mr. Chairman, Vladimir, that would be the case on scenario that would that be, that's your preference to use?
That's the preference for gas-only development.
And that's a six well?
That's a six well.
Okay. If you found down the wall, then you'd be looking at one of the platform designs, or you know, because that's always been a concern, is how fast can you introduce from drilling to when will you start your production. Now you're talking about 18 months, and that would be, like you said, 2013 or early 2014. You know, I have some concerns about permitting and other things. You know, we have this beluga whale issue that's out there, and who knows what the federal government's going to do as far as any control they may have. You know, I've looked at the subsea issue, trying to figure out, you know, can that be done in the Cook Inlet like it's done in the Gulf, and you certainly know a lot more about that than all of us sitting up here at this table, but... if you had to, if you found oil and gas in commercial quantities, would you still try to go with a caisson, or would you end up going, my guess would be, a bigger platform?
We will still utilize at least one caisson to get gas production. The timeline I gave assumes no interference from the, you know, from anybody. This is just go full steam ahead. Possibly two, you know, if we have sufficient gas for two. And then you would, for the oil, you would commission a three-level platform, because where we are, water is fairly deep. Two-level platform probably would not. It would be difficult to design a two-level platform for that work.
Yeah.
And that you're looking at 3 years
for a three-level platform. So that, and that's best-case scenario.
No interference.
And we know that surely there will be no interference from any organization in regards to a new platform being set. Again, I certainly wish that that does happen, but I think that we're kidding ourselves if we think it does. So this helped me a lot as far as trying to determine how you were looking at doing a development there and what kind of time frame. So I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
First question, Representative Olson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bruce, can you give us an update on your Jones Act issues? Have they been resolved, or what's the current status?
The current status, Representative Olson, through the chair, is the Homeland Security and Border Protection issued a notice of violation that's been published. It's, I believe, $15 million. So now the attorneys and everyone that's working that issue with Escobedo are in the mitigating process. So there are factors that will reduce that fine, like the need for natural gas, the impact it would have on national security with the gas issue with Fort Richardson and Elmendorf. So all those issues are being worked right now in the Houston and Washington, D.C. office.
Follow-up? But the fine itself is... automatic, is based on the greater of the price of the tow or the cost of the cargo, in this case being the rig.
Right, it's the value of the rig.
It's automatic because the rig was valued at 14.8, 14.9, 15.
That's correct.
Thanks.
Senator Passman.
Thank you. How do you define a successful drilling program? In other words, what parameters are you looking for? When you get down to where you want to get to, how do you define success?
The commercial reserve that you would need to produce. It's all about economics. Probably for a 6-well caisson, you're looking at 150 BCF discovery, billion cubic feet of gas. You can make that economically viable. On an oil side, for a 3-level platform, somewhere between 50 and 100 million barrels of reserve.
At today's market price. What would you lose? What price would you use to determine that? It'd be lower than today's market price.
Well, I think we used in our original numbers $70.
Okay. Is there additional questions? Question I have, when you had to pull off this year, where are you going to store the rig? Have you determined that? I know you've been talking different people about rate storage for the winter?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. We've identified either Fort Graham or Seward.
Yeah.
Fort Graham has a mooring station that's used for heavy logging timber facilities, and they have some lighthouse facilities onshore that can be utilized. The other spot would be Seward, and Seward has more infrastructure, so that would require taking the rig back out into the Gulf of Alaska. So you'd have to bring up big barges from Seward or big tugboats from Seward and deal with the weather issues. On the way up, we had to sneak around into Prince William Sound for about 5 days while we're waiting for the seas to calm down. So our preference would be Fort Graham because that's still in the Cook Inlet. The mobilization is much quicker. We can use the infield support vessels to tow this barge today.
You're a good captain.
We fired every eye in Fort Graham. Preferred in Fort Graham. We've supported it through Homer.
Yeah. Okay. Another question. Originally, you were supposed to be off-site, I think, the last day of October. You're working toward an extension of that date now?
We've had an agency meeting with the Coast Guard, DNR, the Department of Environmental Conservation, AOGCC, and NOAA. And the person in charge of the NOAA ICE desk has 18 years of experience. She's indicated that this year, based on historic data, ice won't start forming in the Kiski until December 8th. And based on the DEC spill plan reg, even though this is a gas well right now, it could be an oil well. One day they classify it as an oil well. They move 18 days back from that date. And right now the stipulation is that we cease all drilling activities by October 31st. And so that would be drilling and casing, but not the actual well suspension and demobilization of the rig.
Okay, thank you. Additional question, Senator Giesel.
I don't know how to make that go on. So, talk about the beluga. Talk about the beluga issues that.
There.
It was an IQ test. Talk about the beluga issues that you might face.
Okay, Senator Giesel through the chair. We had to get a Corps of Engineer River and Harbor Act permit in order to set the rig into Cook Inlet. And in order to get that permit, because it was a federal permit, we had to go through the federal nexus process, which involved getting other agencies to concur with the Corps of Engineers determination that there was no significant effect to the beluga well. One of the biggest concerns that NIMS had was the 120 decibel level of continuous in-water noise. That was determined to have an adverse effect on the belugas. So what Escapeda did was hired a company out of Arlington, Virginia, it was Marine Acoustics, and we put acoustic monitoring buoys around the rig and actually monitored how much noise, in-water noise, the rig generated and during different activities, drilling, circulating, tripping pipe, just idling. And that report is being produced right now, and that will be really good data for the Cook Inlet, because that data was not available prior to this. We searched everywhere and no one knew how much noise a rig creates. So in the process, we also are required to have beluga well watchers and a notification system in case we've seen beluga wells. But in this area of the Cook Inlet, the belugas aren't generally in the area until mid-December. They don't come back into this area until it's overwintering season. And during the drilling season, they're typically up in the Turnagain Arm and around Susitna's Beluga River. So we haven't seen any. 4 miles to the west of the rig last week, there was a dead beluga floating by. But that came from the Upper Cook Inlet. The fishing game and yet, no. They're looking for it. They want to know why it's
water. Well, hopefully.
But so far, we haven't had any impact on the beluga. We haven't even seen them in the water.
Any additional questions? Seeing that, I'm sure later we'll have some additional questions, but thank you very much for your presentation, and thank you, Escapeda. The one thing I wanted to say, if somebody in the audience has a question that they haven't heard asked or would like some information to be asked, at the end of the last presentation, if we got time between then and when we go on our tour, I'd be happy to take written questions down and ask people if they're able to respond to those questions. But it has to be pertinent to what the presentations have been today. Okay? Draw some. Do a little ring fencing here. So with that, next presenter will be Ethan Schutt. Ethan is Senior Vice President for SERI in coal and coal gas, underground coal gasification. So I'll turn the program over to Ethan here. Let's just take a short break so he gets his slides up running.
Kathy, if you turn the clockwise, it'll come on.
Okay, so now call the meeting back to order. Go ahead, Ethan. Introduce yourself and tell the committee a little bit about yourself and your program.
Sure. My name is Ethan Schutt. I'm the Senior Vice President of Land and Energy Development at SERI. So I oversee both our land and resources group as well as our energy development activities. So we'll be talking about one of our energy projects here today. Appreciate the opportunity to present here. On the resource land and resources side, I think you've heard from a lot of oil and gas exploration production companies here already, and you will hear from more. As a landowner like the state of Alaska, we're very bullish on this limit. Our institutional belief is that we're on the leading edge of a renaissance here in Cook Inlet, that we will see more oil and gas discovery and more economic activity here. So we hold that belief the same, I believe, as the state of Alaska. I won't do much with these early slides other than this one has the outline of the Cook Inlet area for our region. And we'll move right into the presentation about the underground coal gasification project. It is through a company called Stonehorn Ridge, which is a joint venture between SERI and a company called Loris Energy, which is a Houston-based UCG development company. And Loris is an affiliate of Ergo Exergy, which is a UCG technology company based in Montreal. By the way, all the pictures in our slides here are actual field work pictures that have been done on the west side of Cook Inlet. So the picture in this slide is a helicopter sling load to the drilling rig that we were using we had a field program that involved drilling. UCG, while it's not a well-known technology, is something that is developing around the world, including here in Alaska. We're not the only company pursuing this particular technology as an energy solution. It's a technology that converts coal in the ground in a deeply buried coal seam into syngas, which is an energy source. Occurs deep in a deeply buried coal seam below impermeable layers to protect your freshwater aquifers. It eliminates many of the negative environmental impacts of traditional coal mining, handling, transport, and waste. And as we sit here today, there's been significantly more than the 50 test and commercial projects that are completed. Actually, there was a report that was recently released. There's some 50 projects around the world that have been announced or are in development right now for UCG projects. So going forward, I think we will see the emergence of this technology as a factor in our energy area. So this slide is a fairly simple diagram of the basics of how the process works. Drill two wells down to a deeply buried coal seam, create a connection between the wells so that they can communicate, meaning that you can flow a gas from one to the other. One well, you inject an oxidant like air or up to exotic as pure oxygen. You start a combustion reaction. The combustion reaction is about 20% of what's going on, and that provides heat and energy. The heat and energy drives five other chemical reactions, and those chemical reactions are what gasifies the coal and produces the syngas. So the combustion is just a driver, and that consumes about 20% of the energy content, and from that 20% you get the other 80. You produce the syngas up to the surface via the other well, and then you clean it up for use. In reality, of course, it's a little more complicated than that. You really have a matrix of injection and production wells instead of a simple well pair. The picture here is not the scale. It's actually something we're replacing with a different graphic that shows a better scale so that people who aren't familiar with the technology get a better representation of actually how deep the process takes place, so that they're not as so that you don't get this subconscious fear about groundwater contamination. As you're well aware, South Central Alaska does currently need more energy. We're looking for it in the form of traditional oil and gas, but the Cook Inlet Basin as a whole is a world-class coal basin. A world-class coal basin with no coal production. We believe that UCG is a technology by which we can access this world-class energy resource in an environmentally acceptable manner. We've done a significant amount of exploration work that I'll describe in a minute, and through that work we've confirmed that we have a significant commercial coal resource in geological setting that is favorable for UCG development. It's at a location near tidewater, so it can be used for export, and it's at a location near the existing energy infrastructure of Cook Inlet for our own domestic use. Syngas, which is the energy content of syngas, is hydrogen and an H2 molecule and carbon monoxide. Simplest use, you can burn it to make electricity. There are a number of other processes that are established and have commercially available equipment through which you can upgrade the syngas into other energy products. Most interesting for our purposes here is a process called methanation, where you run it over a catalyst and turn it into chemically into methane. The primary element of natural gas, most of our natural gas in Cook Inlet here is just pure methane. So that gives you the local use and potentially an export market. We've also analyzed using it to manufacture clean liquid fuels through a Fischer-Tropsch reactor, which has quite a bit of application in Alaska, and particularly rural Alaska, where we have the diesel crisis going on. And then fertilizer, the Agrium plant actually took natural gas, reformed it into syngas, and made fertilizer. So it does show the flexibility of syngas as a feedstock product if you can make it at a cheaper cost. So a few basics about our project and what we've done to date. It is located on prairie land on the west side. It does have significant commercial coal resources that we assumed were there and now have confirmed are there. We have confirmed multiple six commercial coal seams below 650 feet of depth. We've confirmed favorable geology and other factors. And we're still in the process of ongoing data collection, study modeling, and we will at some point be testing and monitoring. Rough outline of where we are, anchored on the right side of the map, the exploration area outlined up in the upper left, just a little north of the Beluga River. The southern boundary of our tracks, by the way, since we're here in Kenai, is the boundary between the Matthew Borough and the Kenai Peninsula Borough, so the project's located in Matthew. this particular slide is a little bit busy, but it shows two pretty important things. One, the color pattern will show up in the live slide, but I don't think we're reproducing the copies. So the land ownership pattern, the salmon color is theory surface and subsurface, so the entire project area is within that joint state with theory. Two of the major regional faults are depicted on this slide in the Quaki and the Castle Mountains. And then there's a set of road network and well locations of actual wells that we drilled in the 13-hole core drilling program that we've undertaken and completed. Where have we been with our project? We did identify UCG as a potential energy technology and spent about a year validating that it was a legitimate technology and doing diligence on both the technology and a group of technology providers. We subsequently moved into actually doing things in the field. We formed this joint venture, Stonehorn Ridge. We conducted a 13-hole core drilling program where we took a pretty robust set of data. We've got the physical core from the consolidated subsurface down to the total depth of the hole. Hole depth ranged from about 700 feet down to the deepest one I drilled, about 2,600 feet. We collected wireline data, like oil and gas exploration equipment, from most of the holes, so we have a pretty robust set of wireline data. We had field examination of the core as well as laboratory examinations. We did mud logging and cold desorption while we were in the field. And so through all of this data that we've collected, we've built some pretty robust geological models of our resource and site, and through that we've validated the commercial UCG resource and site at the preliminary level, the site favorability for development. We've also commissioned and received a concept level engineering and costing study of surface facilities with estimated product costs for most of the products we talked about earlier. And through this modeling program, we've commissioned specific geological, rock mechanics, and hydrogeological models that all roll into one robust dynamic computer model of the site. We do know that this is a project that's on the cutting edge of a commercial deployment of the technology, so we're being pretty deliberate and responsible in our development. We've been careful, we've taken a lot of time, and we remain committed to seeking input from stakeholders and being very careful along the way. So our next major step, the most important and immediate, is that we've commissioned a high-resolution shallow seismic program that will actually go into the field here in early November. It's about a 25 to 30-day field program, about 8 line miles on 3 lines. So we'll get a lot of new data from the seismic. 8 line miles doesn't seem like much, but when your target depth is 500 to 2,000 feet, you have to place a lot more phones and a lot more charges, so there's a lot more density in the field work for the seismic, so it takes longer and costs more. With that data, we'll complete our preliminary model of the site, incorporating that with the data we already have, and that will help us move to the next phase of the program, which will be a site characterization phase. We'll have more permitting, obviously. We'll begin collecting a really robust set of baseline environmental data and work toward a future development of a commercial project. So that's where we are. We're pretty excited about the project and its potential, but we do also realize that we've got a lot of work in front of us, and happy to answer any questions.
A question comes to mind. Just looking at developing the syngas process, or are you also possibly looking at doing some generation and selling power into the grid, or are you just going to pipe it to someplace like Beluga and let them use that for their feedstock? What's your plans, or have you gone that far yet?
We've thought that through, that at the base you have to make syngas. There's a fair amount of surface facilities that are required to make commercial syngas and make use of it, including cleaning it up. So there are surface facilities that are required to just use it. We will evaluate the various markets. So the natural markets that we see are electric generation, which has two basic scenarios. One would be to sell to the existing Chugach facility at Beluga. The second would be to construct a new power facility for this project. So that's one product market. And then there are methanation to make natural gas. And then you have all the markets that we have available with the methane facilities here in Alaska, plus the ConocoPhillips export terminal at Kiski for LNG. Potentially, if it's still around and available, the aggregate facility here at Kiski as well. And then the third market that I do think has a lot of promise and is interesting at an Alaska scale would be a Fischer-Tropsch reactor to make diesel and or jet fuel as a product. So we are evaluating all of those as we work through the development aspect. If we get to methanation and or synthetic liquid fuels, we'll almost certainly have to have large investors coming along with us to help do that development because the numbers just pretty big and we're working for that.
Any other questions? Senator Pass, then.
One of the questions when people have asked me about this underground coal gasification is, you know, starting that whole underground combustion process makes sense to a lot of people, but how do you turn it off once you got it started?
You know, that is one of the things that comes up, and the answer to that is that your site conditions, you're very deeply buried. You can't have any natural connections to the surface. You're going to be below the water table. But you need control. The environment requires the injection of an oxidant, air or pure oxygen. So the way you control it and turn it off is that you turn off the flow of the oxygen. And over time, it doesn't happen immediately because there is a lot of thermal inertia and other things going on in the combustion chamber. So it doesn't happen immediately, but it does turn off relatively quickly if you stop injecting an oxidant to drive the process. You would not select a site where you could do this at shallow depths or one where you were near an outcrop or something like that with the same coal seam, because then the process could start drawing its own oxygen and you would not have that control. So the modern practice for UCG is all deep enough and wet enough that if you cut off the oxygen, it's easy to supply the process.
Mr. Speaker, and then back. Go ahead, Senator Passman, follow.
Just in the area of the generation of electricity, do you believe that it'll generate electricity at a kilowatt cost comparable to what natural gas currently produces in South Central?
You know, it's hard to be really accurate, but I think it would actually be significantly lower than the current cost of natural gas produced electricity here in Alaska, in South Central. The best analog I can give for you to highlight that is I visited a UCG project in South Africa that's being run or developed by ESCOM, the South African National Utility. They have some of the cheapest electric power in the world because they produce almost all their power from very low-rank domestic coal. They do it in a templated power plant that's 600-700 megawatt coal boilers side by side. Giant sort of sci-fi type of facility when you go in there. The scale is mind-boggling. But because of that scale and the templated design and the very low cost feedstock, it's some of the cheapest electric power in the world. And they are doing the UCG project, and their economics suggest that at commercial scale, the power from the UCG is cheaper than the power from the traditional coal.
The Speaker Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hey, it works if you turn it on. have you got any idea what volumes of gas that you might be talking about? I know it's early in the process. I know, you know, a lot of that depends on what you eventually find and what you eventually decide to move forward with, but is there any estimate on the gas that you could provide?
You know, the technology itself is inherently scalable because coal resources, unlike oil and gas, are pretty much relatively continuous over large areas, and we know that to be true here in Cook Inlet. So we're still finishing the site modeling for our own site, and our seismic will help validate our preliminary estimates. But we think we have more than 300 million tons that could be gasified in this one project area that we have here, based on the preliminary estimates of our BTU value and some of the other inputs. We think that's in excess of equivalent of 4.8 TCF gas fields. So the upper end of the scale is very large. We've looked at models running from about 20 BCF a year to 90 BCF a year of production. There's quite a fall off in the economies of scale in about the middle of that range, where it gets significantly cheaper by volume. But a lot of this is all preliminary, and it has to be tied down as a part of the development process and selling the product to someone.
So, Representative Olson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Several years ago, we funded a feasibility study on a project called Blue Sky originally. What's the difference between your project and Blue Sky?
Sure. Well, we appreciate the Blue Sky product, work product, because we've actually used a lot of the assumptions, and some of that is sort of a starting place. And we've looked at some of the same end results for enhanced oil recovery and whatnot. The basic answer, though, is that the physical and chemical processes of surface gasification that was being proposed for the Project Blue Sky are the same processes that happen in UCG. The difference is that in a surface gasifier, you use a large stainless steel pressure vessel at the surface, and you provide coal to it, and then the gasification takes place and you get syngas. In the underground reaction, what you do is you use the earth in the coal seam as your pressure vessel, so you don't have that large man-made apparatus to gasify the coal. But the process is basically essentially the same, and the output is the same.
Thank you. So you have the economies of scale on this one that we potentially didn't have with Blue Sky.
There is that, and there is the fact that you don't have a lot of very expensive surface infrastructure that you have to build and maintain and operate because you use the earth as the gasification chamber. That's the cost advantage.
Solve one of the mysteries for me.
Sure.
Also, there's no transportation or mining.
Right.
That's another big advantage.
Correct. Through this process, you cut out all of the physical handling of the traditional coal mining, coal handling, coal waste part of the equation, and therefore eliminate those economics as well.
One of these days, I'm not going to ask you to go into it now because I don't even know if you have the answer, but I'd like to know what percentage over the long period of time of the coal that's accessible in your operation would be combusted. And I know it's not 100%, but if you run across that figure sometime and relate to me, I'd be interested in knowing that.
Sure. It does depend on the overall project design and how you lay out your gasification and whatnot, so there are a lot of variables that go into that.
But I think I'm correct in saying that this is coal, a coal resource that, other than this process, probably in the long term would never be mined anyway. Is that right? The level of seams that you're using are?
That's 100% true. These coal seams are so deep and so wet that you would never use them at these locations absent this technology. You're not using a resource that could be mined commercially through underground or surface strip mine type of technology.
And one other question after you said what you said. Are you going to have to do a large dewatering project along with this when you get into that wet coal area? Is that going to have to be dewatered to a point for the combustion, or will that just help control the combustion?
The latter, actually. The water in the coal seam is a necessary product for the reaction itself. And so the water that's required for the process is drawn from the the coal seam aquifers, so you don't have to dewater it, you just ease the process.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming down and sharing that.
Thank you.
We'll take just a brief 5 minute break.
Mr. Tilley.
Yeah. Hello, you've got Paul Thompson from Omat Technologies on the line.
Okay, is it Paul?
Yeah, Paul Thompson and Ram Orenstein on the line.
All right, Paul, I'm going to call the meeting back to order then, and we'll get started with your presentation.
Okay, thank you very much.
I'd like to call the meeting back to order. At this time, we'll hear from Ormat via teleconference. And, Paul, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the chair. For the record, my name is Paul Thompson, and I'm the Director of Policy and Business Development for Ormat Technologies. And with me today is Ram Orenstein, who is also our Director of Business Development and, more importantly, the project lead for Mount Spur. I'm going to walk you basically kind of through where we are in the project today. I'm going to flip through the presentation that I think you all have in front of you, and we're happy to answer any questions you might have, and it's really up to the chair if you want to interrupt us. That's great, or we can take questions at the end. So with that, I'll just begin on page one and remind you all that Ormat Technologies is a publicly traded company. We're going to make some forward-looking statements, and you must remember that our expectations might not always be correct, and that's ever evident in the geothermal industry.
Paul, can I interrupt you a minute?
I'm sorry?
Yeah, let me interrupt you a minute. I just ask to have the questions held until the end. I think that'll work better since we're on teleconference. So we'll take questions at the end. So go ahead.
All right. Thank you very much. Resuming on page three, I'm basically going to have a brief introduction to Ormat Technologies, discuss a little bit about the attributes of geothermal power, discuss the Mount Spur project, give you an updated project status and timeline, and then discuss the cost and matching funds that the state of Alaska have already contributed and Ormat have contributed to this project, and then touch again on the local support, the anticipated cost of power, and the economic and environmental impact to the state of Alaska. Turning the page, just to remind many of you that Ormat Technologies is a leader in the geothermal power sector. Today we own and operate approximately 553 megawatts of geothermal power worldwide. We've supplied over a gigawatt or 1,000 megawatts of equipment in 24 countries. And Ormat is in a unique position in the fact that we are vertically integrated. Many companies will say this today, but our vertical integration is all in-house, meaning that we have the geologists and resource engineers to design the infrastructure needed for resource development. We design and manufacture our own equipment, and then also have the business development team to move these projects forward. Today we employ about 500 people in the United States and a little over 1,100 worldwide. If you flip to page five, you will see where we have projects throughout the world. The little boxes there showing you that we have a large breadth, and I think the important thing to note is the 30 megawatts of operating geothermal power in Hawaii, which shares some of the same geologic conditions that we are working with at Mount Spur. Turning to page six, I would just remind all of you that Ormat's commitment to Alaska started in 1975 when we supplied over 100 remote power units on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. We also tested our first geothermal unit in Alaska in 1979 at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. So we're very committed to trying to get online the first commercial geothermal project, or large-scale commercial geothermal project in the state of Alaska. Flipping to page seven, we're going to discuss briefly the key attributes of geothermal development. It's a baseload energy resource, and what that means is we produce power 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, and that's very unique to geothermal. And the way I started explaining it to people is if you buy a generator, a 100 megawatt generator, and put it in your garage, and never turn it on, it doesn't produce any power. And if you turn that generator on for 1 hour, it produces 100 megawatt hours. And if you leave it on for every hour of the day, for an entire year, it's going to get up to 8,760 megawatt hours. That's a key attribute to us that you don't find in other renewable resources. Once these projects are up and operating, they can be very cost competitive, and they're highly reliable. We're a proven technology with over 1,100 megawatts deployed worldwide. Once we have the projects up and operating, there's no fuel cost risk, and we can offer fixed long-term pricing. The other great attribute is that these systems, especially Ormat systems, tend to be closed-loop systems with near-zero emissions, where we can utilize air cooling and recycle the geothermal brine that we're pumping up from the reservoir. This is key in states like Alaska and in western U.S., where we don't consume any additional water that's so precious. We also can create long-term and high-quality jobs. If we move to the next slide, kind of following the guidelines we've used in Senate Resource Committee hearings in the past, we wanted to just outline some of the development inhibitors to geothermal development. One is resources are scarce. That's not so much a problem in Alaska, where we know there's a lot of volcanic activity, but they're also incredibly hard to find. And that's one of the issues we're running into today at the Mount Spur project. They also require a high upfront capital expenditure, or CapEx, and this really kind of separates companies with a good equity position from those who have to raise capital in such a risky environment where they're trying to drill wells to incredible depths and in very difficult geological conditions. Slide 9. The reason we have slide 9 is to kind of recap the fact that there's approximately 11,000 megawatts of geothermal deployed throughout the world. 24 nations have utility-scale geothermal generation, and most of them, or actually all of them, have policies in place that have been instrumental to getting those initial geothermal projects up and off the ground and moving forward. And so we've been very thankful to the state of Alaska for not only amending some of their existing royalty legislation, but also looking at grants and other avenues for getting capital into this development. If we flip to page 10, slide 10, we kind of recap the project. For those of you who don't know, Mount Spur is located about 75 miles west of Anchorage. And you've got a Google Earth picture there. I don't know if you can see clearly Mount Spur is there near the Lake Chacachamba. Moving to slide 11, updating kind of our current status and estimated timeline. If you'll remember, Ormat leased 36,000 acres of state lands in October of 2008, and we begun our non-intrusive exploration in the summer of 2009, and continue that into the summer of 2010. We then drilled two exploration holes, core holes, to the depth of 1,000 feet in September of 2010. And then, as you'll see on the timeline, we drilled one deep exploration hole to approximately 4,000 feet in depth in the summer of 2011. I'm going to discuss kind of the results of that drilling in a couple of slides, but we wanted to show you some pictures from, if you flip to slide 12, you'll see in the top right-hand corner our initial much smaller rig that was used for drilling the core holes in the summer of 2010. And then if you look to the slide below, you'll see the much larger rig that is required for drilling the full-size production well to 4,000 feet in depth. Flipping to slide 13, you'll see a picture of core. This is the rock that we've pulled out of our core hole that we drilled, both in 2010 and 2011. And what's unique about this, and the reason we wanted to show it, is that we've donated over 6,000 feet of core to the Geological Material Center at Needle River. And this is something we wanted to do to help the state of Alaska learn about, you know, like Ormat is, what are the conditions there and what's going on with the conglomerate rock and so forth that we've encountered in our drilling at Mount Spur. Moving to page 14, our results from the 2009-2010 exploration and drilling work were very encouraging. And that brought us back in 2011 to drill our deep core hole. And the results to date have been less encouraging. The rock type that we encountered is a conglomerate rock, which is more porous and doesn't do as good a job of trapping the heat. And we've also measured temperatures that were much cooler than expected. We also had rig issues, which slowed down our drilling timeline. And so we are at the phase now of analyzing that work. And if you flip to page 15, we're currently analyzing the results and updating our 3D geological model. All of the data that we've received to date is being shared with the state, DNR, DGGS, and AOGCC, and we're in discussion with these agencies to get thoughts on what can we do better in our continued exploration efforts to find what we believe is a pretty prolific geothermal resource at Mount Spur. The next step is to update the exploration plan that we currently have, which may include a recommendation to rotary drill to a much deeper depth. And we wanted to kind of point out that this project is not dead. We've gotten a lot of questions about is this project dead, and it certainly is not. We are putting our best talent on this and trying to reevaluate, where we can drill and how do we get below the conglomerate rock to what, again, we think is a prolific geothermal resource. We're also working with the state and we think some of the best talent in Alaska to make this project work. Flipping to slide 16, and the rest of the slides, just kind of recap for your committee where we are and how the state of Alaska has been so instrumental in moving this project forward. Slide 16, starting with the fact that Ormat did lease 36,000 acres for about $3.5 million. We are currently paying about $100,000 in annual rent on that lease position. And the non-intrusive exploration, the exploration, drilling, and permitting, Ormat has spent about $3 million approximately, and the state has spent $2 million. So total, Ormat has spent about $7 million to date, utilizing the state's $2 million. And what we've done is kind of extended the exploration drilling period. We thought we'd be at resource confirmation moving into 2012, but we've moved that to 2013, expecting to have to continue drilling before we have resource confirmation in 2012. Moving to slide 17, as a reminder, we expect the capacity at Spur to be somewhere between 50 to 100 megawatts. Our target is still to get 50 megawatts online in 2016. Obviously, that target becomes tighter and tighter as we have trouble locating the resource. And we hope to expand the project, again, possibly to 100 megawatts. Geothermal, this project and its impact on the rail belt, we think it's a possible near-term solution to bridging the gap to larger projects such as the Sitna or the Wapana hydro projects. As a reminder, 95% availability for a 50-megawatt project would produce about 416 gigawatt hours a year. Turning the page to slide 18, the estimated cost of power for this project is 12 cents per kilowatt hour. It's a fixed price. We are still in discussions with utilities trying to get to that point. But utilities really like these projects. Geothermal, like we've discussed earlier, is baseload. And we're finding that in more and more situations, that cost is really magnified when we take into account integration costs. Because geothermal is baseload, providing a steady stream of electrons, we don't have the integration costs that other renewables do. And what's interesting is many times that integration cost is not incorporated in their offered purchase price. And so that's something that your committee and the PUC in Alaska need to continue to remember, RCA in Alaska. The price is higher than the current avoided cost of 5 to 10 cents. However, it's comparative to one of their alternatives, and the avoided costs are like we believe are likely to go up in the future. Flipping to page 19, we just wanted to talk about additional funds that have not been utilized yet. As many of you are aware, the fiscal year 2012 budget had a direct appropriation for $12.5 million, and ORMAT was awarded the AEA Round 4 grant for $2 million. Because of the lackluster drilling results we've received in 2011, we are working very closely with AEA and DNR, as we've said, on updating the scope of work. And once we have that, we're going to recommend a new plan of exploration and present that to AEA and DNR. The scope of work has changed. We expected to be drilling three wells in 2012. Now we're looking at maybe one much deeper well, and we're going to evaluate the impact that has on the plan. Turning to just to remind the committee or introduce them, we have a great community support. We've worked very well with Tyonic, the Kenai Peninsula Borough, and Anchorage, all of which have provided letters of recommendation and have just been overwhelmingly supportive of our efforts on this project. Environmental and renewable energy communities are also very supportive. And flipping to page 21, the project has been verbally supported by all six rail belt utilities and ArcTech as a potentially viable near-term solution. So we're excited to continue working on this project, and I think we'll go to slide 22, just to touch on the economic and environmental impacts. 100 megawatts of geothermal power is enough power to provide 50 high-paying jobs, well over 100 construction jobs, and that impact expands to approximately 200 local vendors. We hope, once this project gets up and operating, to be able to fuel the local economy with over $850 million to supply and keep the plant operating over its 30-year life. The environmental impact for geothermal development is substantial. A 100-megawatt geothermal project annually could save 600 million BTUs of depleting Cook Inlet natural gas, and that's roughly the equivalent of Anchorage's entire residential heating consumption. We can also avoid the emission of 320,000 tons of CO2. In summary, you know, we're still very excited about the Mount Spur project. We think this can offer a source of clean, reliable, field-proven baseload power to the rail belt. We think it could offer significant relief for the Cook Inlet natural gas consumption. It could be a significant contributor to meeting the renewable goals of the state of Alaska, provide long-term price stability, be a near-term solution for power concerns as Alaska brings on larger hydro projects, and provide high-quality, long-term green jobs. So with that, I want to thank the committee and the chairman for your time, and Rahm and I are available for any questions you might have.
First question, this is Senator Wagoner from the chair. You you referenced 100 megawatts quite a few times in your presentation. Is that what you think the maximum capacity of the spur area is, or is there a chance to expand that in different sections of your leases there?
Hi, it's Ron Lorenstein here. So this number comes more from comparison to other projects we have built. The biggest geothermal plant we have built in the Philippines was about 140 megawatts. So theoretically, it could be even bigger, but at this point, we don't speculate too much. We'll be very, very happy if we are able to ultimately find a 50 megawatt resource there, and even more than that if we have 100. So it's an ambitious target as it is.
Okay, thank you. Additional questions? Representative Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question had come up earlier about
the rock and the unsuitability of that rock as part of the thermal source, and you were talking about drilling deeper. At one point, I think there was conversation about drilling laterally or a lateral extension. Is the rig that you have or that you've utilized for drilling the bore over there now, is that capable of that, or does that require a different kind of rig to do those lateral drills?
Okay, so I will answer through the chair to Representative Seaton. So, first of all, we currently don't have a rig there. We caught for the summer and have then released it. The rig is now somewhere else. It's a contractor rig. The rig that was there is a core rig that could go deep, directly up to, say, 6,000 feet and couldn't really drill directionally. I think we ended up with maybe 18 degrees direction. The rig, and as Paul explained, at this point it's too early for us to say what exactly we want to do next. It all depends on the work that the geologists are doing, both ours and the state's geologists. And once they come up with an updated plan that we think may include drilling a larger diameter using rotary drilling to deeper depth, then we'll see. From what I'm hearing, they'll probably want to go vertically or close to vertically and try to go beneath that layer of conglomerate. But again, at this point, it's more speculation than a plan.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the question of what size, kind of seismic data do you have for this over there? Is that 2D or 3D seismic, or what kind of information is currently available on the Mount Spur area that you're drilling?
Okay, I will answer that to the chair, to Representative Seaton. So, again, I'm not a geologist. I'm a mechanical engineer, but I will explain what our geologists have told me. They actually did not do seismic surveys on Mount Spur because from their understanding, because this is a, from what they tell me, since this is a seismic active area anyway because it's an active volcano, they thought seismic data, you know, is important for crew safety, et cetera. We're working with the Alaska Volcano Observatory, but they did not think it would be very valuable to geothermal. So actually the technologies that they used before the drilling were pretty impressive. We did aerial surveys, like aerial magnetic surveys. We did high-resolution photography. We did LIDAR. That was very helpful. And then we did some on-ground exploration, primarily ground gravity and ground magnetotellurics. And the combination of all of these was used to create a geological model that from which they selected the drill targets and moved to drill target to drilling. And from what I'm told, it's probably sufficient, so that's why probably our next step will not be, from what I'm told by a geologist, additional surveys. It will probably be additional drawing in terms of the recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Pascal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What temperatures would you need to find at that deeper depth in order to believe that you could produce 100 megawatts, and when would you believe that you would have that answer?
Through the chair to Senator Pascavan, for such a project, we really need temperatures in the range of 350 Fahrenheit or up. That's what we're hoping to find.
And when would you expect to know the results of whether you have that sustainable temperature?
Well, again, unfortunately, I mean, we were hoping to get to that temperature this year with a 4,000-foot core hole that we drilled. Some of our models expected that to happen, and unfortunately, it did not. The temperature we actually encountered was less than half of that. And the explanation, the reason we think it is because, again, the rock is different from what pretty much everybody expected. It's rock that doesn't contain heat very well, and there's probably more mixing with the glacial waters that are on the ground than what we thought. So, unfortunately, we're not where we hoped we would be a few months ago. But looking forward, as we explained, we're now trying to refresh the model, feed all the new data into it. Hopefully, our geologists, together with the state geologists, will come up with a new plan that will suggest finding this temperature as it may be at a slightly different location and at a deeper depth. So I guess the short answer is probably only after we drill another deeper well will we know if we found that temperature or not. Unfortunately, with all the technology out there, it's still impossible to prove a certain temperature is there without drilling and measuring it.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're talking about drilling a larger bore, deeper well. How much more cost is that going to add to the project? Do you have estimates on that?
So the chair to the senator. We don't have, it's a little premature to answer that. We do know that the major cost is going to be logistics. So far, to use heli-borne core rigs, the type of rigs that the mining industry uses, which saved a lot on logistics, because as you know, there are no roads. I think the nearest road ends almost 20 miles from our leases. So that's going to be the biggest logistical challenge. If we need to mobilize in a larger rig that cannot be economically heli transportable, we'll have to probably build a winter road, an ice road, and that is from the estimate that we have, and we shared a report last year with the legislature, an engineering company in Alaska assumed about $5 million just to build a nice road for one season, mobilize a rig. So, like the numbers we gave AEA for the round 4 grant application, we ended up with more than with about $11 million for this first deep, larger bore hole if you combine the ice road and the drilling cost. But again, that is preliminary information that we will be refining once we have an updated plan.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that changes the cost per kilowatt hour that you could produce. Would that be true? You'd have to recalculate those numbers. It won't be worth anymore.
Well, through the chair to the senator, I would say potentially it could, though in our previous models we did anticipate that ultimately we will have to do that. We'll have to bring a larger rig and drill full size commercial geothermal production and injection wells. So theoretically, if this next well, assuming that's going to be the next step, is highly successful, the impact on the economics may not be significant, but if ultimately we come to a conclusion that the resource in general is either much deeper or colder than we assumed in our initial model, then you are definitely correct. Then the economics will change, and again, we think. You know, this is a true exploration campaign, meaning the results could be negative in terms of the commercial viability of a project up there.
Any further questions? Speaker Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Probably not working again, but I guess to Robert Paul, a couple of
things. Maybe my mind's not correct, but I thought that we had appropriated last year's budget, Mr. Chairman, since you're here, about $70.5 million for Ormats plus the additional $2 million, I think, was what was original. Now, maybe the governor vetoed part of that, but that's the numbers that's sticking in my brain, so we'll work on the numbers later. I guess my questions would be, you've drilled 2,000-foot holes and didn't find the heat source you were looking for. Then you went in, that was in 2010, and this summer you went in and drilled another well to 4,000-foot and found half, basically close to half the temperature that you're looking for, or less. Because I don't know, is there a depth that... Is there any certain depth that you have to go to, or how deep can you go before you finally say you can't find the temperature that you're looking for? Or is there a depth in there?
Through the chair to Speaker Chenault. First of all, on the grant, you are correct. There's a change. We originally asked for $18 million in a direct appropriation that together with a $2 million AEA round four would have brought us to the 20 that we were shooting for. Ultimately, the governor didn't veto it, but it did reduce the appropriation from the requested 18 to 12.5. So that's the discrepancy. To answer your second question, we have developed geothermal resources in variable depths ranging from 1,000 foot or even less in one of our bigger plants here in Reno, Nevada, all the way to 8,000 foot and more, for example, in our Hawaii plant. And that's pretty much the range of commercial geothermal plants. In Mount Spur, based on our previous models, we were hoping we could find a resource somewhere in the 3,000 to 5,000 foot depth, and that's why this year's core hole, which we wanted to drill almost to 5,000 but had to stop at 4,000 because of mechanical issues, we were hoping we would tap into that resource, and we found our worst resource. Looking forward, so again, I would say anywhere between 8,000 foot is still doable. We've done that elsewhere. But we will plug it all into the economic model. Ultimately, in geothermal development, the economics are set by primarily exactly what you touched upon, the combination of the depth and the temperature. If it's shallow and hot, then it's golden. If it's deep and cold, it doesn't work. But if it's deep and very hot, it can work. Or if it's very shallow and not very hot, it can still work. So the devil is in the details, and we still don't have all the answers we want.
And I guess just a side comment, you know, what little, you know, and I shouldn't say little when we're talking about millions of dollars to drill some of these test holes, but the difference between $2 million and $7 million or $12 million for a project that's going to bring on or could have the potential to bring on 50 to 100 megawatts of power for, let's say, our lifetime and beyond, will probably pencil out to be pretty minute in all reality. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Like geothermal, Mr. Speaker, the longer you produce it, I mean like hydro, the longer you produce it, the better it looks. Look at Bradley Lake now.
You're correct.
So, okay, any other questions? Well, we've gone over our time a little, but we want to thank Ormat for their presentation, and hopefully we can get down to some hotter water.
Well, Chairman, thank you very much for your time, and we greatly appreciate it and look forward to seeing you all again very soon.
All right.
Thank you very much.
The next presenter will be ConocoPhillips. Darren, you're up. Tell us a little bit about yourself and give your first presentation, if you would, please.
Good afternoon, and thank you for inviting us. Mr. Chairman, I'm with the committee. For the record, my name is Darren Mesrinch. I'm the manager of the Cook Inlet assets for ConocoPhillips Alaska. Cook Inlet, or ConocoPhillips, operates three assets in the Cook Inlet area. On the west side of the Cook Inlet, we have our onshore Beluga gas field. Offshore, we have the North Cook Inlet unit, also known as the Cyanic Platform, and, of course, the Kenai LNG plant. Between the Beluga River unit and the North Cook Inlet unit, ConocoPhillips operates approximately 130 million standard cubic feet per day of natural gas production. I understand that the focus of today's hearing is on the impact that the bullet line to South Central might have on Cook Inlet exploration and production, and the impact a large discovery in the inlet could have on a bullet line. But as we communicated to the chair prior to this hearing, I cannot speculate on what might happen under the various scenarios the committee has described. We believe in letting the market dictate the most efficient and economic solution, and we believe that market forces will dictate what ultimately happens with regard to Cook Inlet gas supply. However, one of the historically significant components of the Cook Inlet gas market, one that drove early development of gas in the inlet and helped provide a market for gas production in excess of the utility requirement, is the Kenai LNG plant. My very brief comments today will focus on the LNG plant, its history, an update on current status, and its future potential. The Kenai LNG plant has been operating for more than 40 years and is currently the only significant industrial user of natural gas in South Central Alaska. The Kenai LNG plant received its current two-year export license on October 5th of 2010. The license extension will expire March 31st of 2013. ConocoPhillips closed the acquisition of Marathon's 30% interest in the plant in late September and now owns 100% of the facility. In February, we announced the likely shutdown of the plant in the April or May timeframe. Based upon the decline in market conditions, which meant that the continued operations were not commercially viable. The unfortunate March tsunami in Japan and our success in marketing LNG to new customers enabled continued operation of the plant. The facility is currently expected to operate into November prior to being shut down and preserved for an interim period for potential future use. The local utilities have previously testified, and again today, that they forecast a likely shortage of natural gas supply for South Central Alaska in the next few years, unless a new source of gas is identified and developed very quickly. The indicated LNG imports and regasification could be necessary in the near future to help fill the shortfall. In this import scenario, the plant, its dock, and its LNG tanks could serve a role in the interim solution where LNG is imported and regasified to supply natural gas to the South Central utilities and users. In the long term, the plant could be refurbished to serve as an LNG export facility for either exporting local gas, if a significant Cook Inlet gas discovery is made, or as a means of selling North Slope gas if a North Slope pipeline to South Central gas, South Central is constructed. If no future opportunities for the Kenai LNG plant materialize, we will permanently shut down our plant operations. However, that is not our desired outcome, and we are exploring potential future opportunities with customers and stakeholders. Our purchase of Marathon's interest demonstrates that we believe there are future opportunities for the facility. While we are encouraged in evaluating commercial opportunities for use of the plant, we cannot speculate on which outcome is more likely. I realize my comments today are more limited than many would like, but the nature of our business precludes speculating or disclosing commercial discussions. However, we at ConocoPhillips believe it is important to officially and for the record let it be known that we are still evaluating the role of the Kenai LNG plant in the various scenarios that might develop with regard to both Cook Inlet exploration and development of the Alaska North Slope gas resources. For 40 years, the plant has been integral to the vitality of the Cook Inlet gas market, and it may yet play a similar role for decades to come. Mr. Chairman, this concludes my prepared remarks. I'm available to address any questions you may have.
Questions from the table here? Senator Passman?
Sure. On the import scenario that you were addressing, what volumes is it that you would put together to, you know, to import, and then also the refurbishing, what quantities could you export if you refurbished?
To the chair, Senator Batten, regarding the imported LNG, the utilities, I can't really speculate on what the future will bring, but the utilities have testified a sort of increasing rate of production imports, starting off maybe 2 or 3 BCF a year, building up to maybe 20 or more. So that's kind of the magnitude. To give you a feel, 20 BCF is something like 10 tankers shipments a year. Regarding the second question on, maybe you should repeat the question, make sure I get it right.
In other words, you were indicated that you were, if depending upon discoveries or depending upon an in-state bullet line, that you might consider refurbishing for export purposes. What capacity would the plant have if you were to refurbish it?
Through the chair, Senator Pastan, if we did refurbish the plant, its nameplate capacity was something like 240, 250 million standard cubic feet per day. In the near term, we could restart the plant and potentially ramp up the levels close to that. If it goes a longer time, then the facilities are 40 years old. We'd have to do some retooling, some reinvestment. The cost would be higher, and we could potentially get back to that same level, but the cost would be higher and the time would be delayed.
Speaker Schnall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Darren, the high output of the plant was about 63 Bs a year.
I'd probably something maybe a little more than that.
Yeah, somewhere around there. So, I mean, just, I always get confused on the 200 million a day whenever I look at the big picture, and the big picture is somewhere around 60 Bs a year is what the Conoco facility used to use. Agrium was around 53 Bs back when it was at 100 or 110%. So, I mean, those are the kind of volumes that when we start talking bullet lines with 180 Bs a day or a year, it's easier for me to equate those numbers into real numbers that make more sense than 250 Ms a day. Or so, just a comment, but that's about what the plant used to expend in energy, was about 60 Bs a year, somewhere in that vicinity.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When we're talking about the import solution with LNG that Arctic was testifying about, what kind and extent of retooling and time delay is there for a plant that was a export facility to make that changeover and kind of ballpark understanding of cost?
To the chair, Representative Seaton, regarding the physical changes, the dock would just be used to bring in ships instead of sending them away full, and then it would be offloaded into the LNG tank. So that part doesn't change, it just goes the other direction. What we would have to do is build a regasification facility, which is basically just heating up the LNG and making it gas again before it's compressed and sent into the pipeline. So that's the process change that would occur. So the existing facilities, really, the liquefaction really doesn't help except for making the compression and the regasification process. So a lot of it is brand new, but the dock and the LNG tank could be used again. Those are real valuable in that process. Regarding costs, that's confidential right now, but it's material, but it's nothing like talking about the rate that pipeline, if that helps. That's about as far as I can go on that.
Follow up.
Thank you. And in a regas facility, I'm just not familiar with them. Is that using seawater as the heat source, or is that using air, or, I mean, I presume you're not burning, or are you burning fuel to do that? What's the regas kind of option for sale?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, so you would have the liquid LNG coming in, and you'd have something like steam on the other side of the heat exchanger heating it up. It's something simple like a shell and tube heat exchanger.
Okay, so,
Paul, go ahead.
So, basically, it'd be using some natural gas on the other side for the steam conversion. So, that's
through the chair, Representative Steven, that's correct. There would be some natural gas consumption in the process.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Additional questions? Senator Pastman.
It's a little bit, again, staying on the export capacity. If there was a greater than 60 BCF per year supply and a purchaser on the other side, has ConocoPhillips considered potential of building a new export facility?
Through the chair, Senator Pastman, if there is more supply, I guess we can't really speculate. I mean, the market, if you have North Slope gas coming, I'm sure the developers of the gas would be looking at those options, but it would depend on the price and the commercial and fiscal terms. And until that's all really sorted out, I can't comment on what the final solution would look like.
Well, I'll ask the question, nobody else will. Drilling down into this whole thing, we were distributed a sheet, and it's the information that ASAP has already distributed in their report, where they say at 500 MCF a day, their tariff would be $9.63 per MCF. That's with a commercial user. There's only one commercial user in Cook Inlet or the South Central area that could possibly use that much gas at this time. That's your plant. So can you say that at this time you plan to look at maybe an extension on your export license in the near future? Or is that just guesswork on their part that you're the last man standing, and that if they could get gas to you, you would ship your gas down the line if they get a line to go?
Chairman Wagner, we would have to look at the events as they unfold. Right now, we have to assess the situation and look at the commercial and fiscal terms. So I can't say what we would do until we saw that proposal really in front of us. Like I said before, we are trying to bought more of the plant. We do believe it has long-term option value, but until we see how that materializes, I can't really say what will happen.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none? We're going to get done early. Thank you, Darren. I appreciate you coming, and stay in touch. We don't want you to go away. Those are good jobs in our community. So.
Thank you.
Oh, Senator Giesler.
Mr. Chair, I wondered, finished talking about the LNG plant, I wondered if we could go back and invite S&P to come back up. I had another question for them, if Bruce could step forward.
Certainly. Again. Bruce or Vladimir or both of them?
Since we're done a little early, would that be okay?
Which do you want?
Bruce would be fine.
Okay.
Just we have a couple minutes.
Sure.
Bruce, I'm looking here at your chart pack, and it's chart number 42, where you have the kitchen development timing, and you show the different time frame on. And one of the things that I noticed is that you have first production for gas at the end of bar group number 3 and first production of oil in the middle of number 4. And I'm just wondering how that will work with AOGCC, who typically requires that the oil be produced first before the gas be taken off.
Senator Diesel, through the chair, AOGCC requires that if the two formations are together, for instance, if the gas cap is supplying the pressure for the oil formation, in the geologic structures we're looking at, we have the Sterling gas sands, the Beluga gas sands, the upper Tyonic gas sands, and then it gets into the oil-bearing formation. So they are separate, and they're really distinct. If you drilled into an oil reservoir that had a gas cap, you'd have to produce the gas first, because you'd have to produce the oil first because the gas is the driver. But in this situation, we're drilling into gas sands and gas reservoirs and oil reservoirs. They're separate.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Escapade? Anybody got any other questions? Any other presenters that are still here that you want to ask?
Thank you.
Seeing none, thank you. And with that, that'll conclude the meeting today until 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Lisa! Yeah. Thank you.